You want to then?
This meeting is called to order. We do have everybody here. I didn't look down to yes. Okay, before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
Good morning. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We will begin right away with the Regulations Committee. We've kind of changed the order, and we'll do regs first. Commissioner Friedkin.
Okay. Morning, everyone. First order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Bivens. Second by Falcone. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, land and water plan update. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Chairman. A couple of items just from the National Marine Fisheries Service that I want to bring to everybody's attention. They have recently tested and approved some new bycatch reduction devices to go on shrimp trawls. They're particularly looking at attenuating impacts on juvenile red snapper. And so we're going to need to look at adopting those regulations. And so our team from Coastal Fisheries is going to bring that forward in the August meeting. So just want to give everyone a heads up about those new bycatch reduction devices. So we knew they were coming, and so we'll talk about those in August. Also want to let folks know that the National Marine Fisheries Service has also acted on tightening the recreational fishery on red snapper out in the federal waters in the Gulf. We suspected that would happen after our decision not to be consistent with the federal regulations. That has indeed transpired. The result of that is they have essentially closed the fall season to recreational fishing for red snapper out in the federal waters of the Gulf. So we're going to be working with NIMS on that issue to come. Obviously, it's something that we're concerned about and have some disagreement over. I want to just also thank those of you that were able to attend the graduation ceremony last Friday. Chairman Holt, Mr. Falcone, and Martin were there for our new game warden class. It's a great, bright group of cadets, 36 cadets. Particularly pleased that 13 of the graduates had worked for the department before, and 11 had come up through our internship program, which was particularly nice. 9 of whom I think were in law enforcement through the internship program there, but we had graduates that worked in fisheries and communications and state parks, and so they bring a lot of experience and knowledge from other parts of the agency to the table. They also have a very proud tradition of law enforcement in their families. We had the sons of a Texas Ranger. We had the son or the daughter of a superintendent, sons of a DPS trooper and a former DPS captain, and the son of a county law enforcement investigator. So great, great tradition there. We're really proud of those cadets and the graduates. They made it through a pretty arduous academy. It'll be the last class that formally graduates from our 51st Street Academy, so that's very significant in that regard. And particularly pleased, Chairman, that we had Governor Perry there,
and he
gave a great
nice
address.
Nice time. Mm-hmm.
Yep, took a picture with every graduate.
Yeah,
very, very nice. So, last thing I want to mention is the Toyota Bass Classic there at Lake Fork last month went very, very, very well. We were very pleased with that. It generated $250,000 contribution. Thank you to Toyota to help our inland fisheries and educational programs and outreach to youth fishermen, and particularly trying to help engage folks with creating more opportunities in urban neighborhoods to get them out to fish. One of the really interesting outcomes of that tournament is a new kind of method that was instituted at the tournament, in which all fish were caught and then weighed and released, as opposed to caught and brought back to the bank to formally weigh. And I think this is something that's got the attention of a lot of tournament organizers around the country to look at ways for managing tournaments, particularly when you have slot limits and other things that are a little hard to work around in professional tournaments. So the news folks like that, and I think our fisheries biologists were very pleased with that as well. So exciting news on that front. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that's it for me on the land and water front.
All right, thank you. Committee item two, request permission to review rules.
All right.
morning, Commissioners. I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. We are required under the government code to review all of our rules once every 4 years. The rule review has to include an assessment of whether the reasons for adopting the rule continue to exist. When we review these rules, we also try to do a very meaningful review and make sure that they're accurate. For example, we may have position titles that have changed, that sort of thing. To begin this process, we're required to publish a notice in the Texas Register that says we're going to start this rule review process. And then after we complete the process, we have to publish another notice that says that the rules have either been readopted, adopted with changes, or repealed. Normally, this occurs over three meetings. The first meeting, which is in this instance today, staff is going to request permission to begin the rule review process. Then the second meeting, we will request permission to publish any changes. As we go through these rules, a lot of times we're going, and most of the time, we're going to find things that need to be changed. In the third meeting, we would request permission to adopt the changes and to adopt basically the completion of the rule review. This is kind of a busy slide, but it shows you the schedule for the chapters. The ones that are highlighted are the ones that we're looking to begin today. So we are requesting permission to begin the rule review process for Chapters 51, Executive, Chapter 52, Wildlife and Fisheries, Chapter 55, Law Enforcement, and Chapter 61, Design and Construction. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Ann. Any questions, Brian?
Did we do it 4 years ago? Is this so we're at our four-year? Okay.
Our regular four-year process.
Thank you. I'll authorize staff to begin the rule review. Committee item number three, Migratory Game Bird Proclamation. Vernon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Vernon Bevel, and I'm Program Director for Small Game and Habitat Assessment. I'm here today to begin to brief you on a process that will drag on until your August commission meeting with several benchmarks along the way, and that has to do with setting the annual seasons for migratory game birds. We are asking permission to publish our proposed changes in the Texas Register to start this process, and the first major decision will be that for our new executive director to make in July, with the early season decisions, and in the late season decisions will be brought back to the commission in August. So there are a couple of items that I'll go into a little more detail on. One relates to a change in our dove season structure in South Zone, and the other relates to how we are proposing to handle crane change. And we're looking for public comment on both of those to steer us to a final decision. Pretty much unchanged for the north and central dove zones from previous years, what we are proposing to do to accommodate a request that's been going on for two or three years in Jim Hogg County to move Jim Hogg County out of the special white wing zone, and which right now we cannot accommodate because we will be in the fourth year of a five-year evaluation of that white wing extension up to Highway 90 that we made several years ago, and so the feds will not let us out of that survey until it is completed. And until we do that, we can't make any formal boundary changes. However, if we take the last week of the first split out of the South Zone season and move that week to the end of the season, which we have the framework to accommodate, we can accommodate that interest in that area. And by proposing it this way, we get a chance to test the waters on the public reaction to see if that is generally okay or whether there's a lot of negative feedback to it, and then we would probably not do that. But we're just looking for a way to address an issue that has been requested repeatedly and actually gone through the Migratory Advisory Board on more than one occasion with a lot of support from that group as well. So that's the first significant issue. For the new commissioners, we either have a 9-day or 16-day teal season in September. Our commission policy established a number of years ago that if it is 16 days, it's the last three, four weekends in September. If it's 9 days... If it's nine days, it'll be the last two weekends in September. We try to establish seasons for whale, snipe, and woodcock commensurate with other more significant game bird seasons to accommodate that opportunity for hunters in the field. For ducks, mergansers, and coots, there are surveys going on as we speak in the breeding grounds. We will not have feedback on those until sometime in July when our flyway council meets. We anticipate that it will be another liberal season package, and this is sort of what it will look like for our High Plain Mallard Management Unit in West Texas. And for the north and south zones, we have, with the liberal package, we've run our season structure concurrently. We have zones that at such time that we ever go to a more restricted package, then the zones come into play with how we would set seasons with fewer days. We are in the final year of our hunter choice bag experiment, which is in an aggregate bag of one hen mallard, one pintail, or one canvasback, or one dusky duck, which is any other combination of mottled duck, black duck, or Mexican duck. And after this season is over, we will be involved in a flyway-wide evaluation of the success of that particular approach to reducing the need for the seasons within seasons for pintails and canvasbacks, which has generally been 39 days sandwiched somewhere in the season structure.
You're doing that with the feds?
Yes, sir. Yes, feds have concurred with this approach, and we're looking at it, and we'll be evaluating it over the next year or so. For the eastern goose zone, primarily in the eastern goose zone, we hunt light geese, Canada geese, and white-fronted geese. White-fronted geese are among our most important goose stocks available to our eastern goose zone hunters. We have a 72-day season proposed with a two-bird daily bag limit. That season closes earlier than the other two, as you can see. For the western goose zone, light geese and dark geese are more abundant together, and we are able to close those two seasons at the same time. Now, for our light goose conservation order, we are proposing delaying it in the western goose zone because we start generally right after the regular season closes. But we're proposing to have a longer crane season in a portion of the western goose zone, and would not open the light goose conservation season until that crane season ended on the 8th. And we would open that on the 9th, as you can see in this other slide. Zone B would close on the 8th. Zone A would close on the 8th. We would go to the conservation order. Again, this is one of those issues where if we get a lot of negative feedback, we may rethink this recommendation before we come back to the commission with a final proposal. And, Mr. Chairman, that ends my presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Excellent.
Yes, sir.
Back to the pintail.
Yes, sir.
Not anything regarding what you have here, except are we continuing our study on pintail work here in Texas with regard to the weights of the females, etc. Where they have not been putting on.
Right. There's been some issues about the condition of pintails going back north. And I believe that study is still ongoing, although I don't specifically know. I can get back to you with some details on that.
But it's TPWD's study.
TPWD is participating in the study. Yes.
Have they come to any decision yet as to
I haven't.
The benchmark is here, and we're underneath the benchmark.
I haven't seen any final findings and recommendations from that study, although there may be have been some that just hadn't crossed my path yet. I just don't know. I can get that information to you by tomorrow.
And on the stop also.
Mm-hmm.
I see that we're maintaining a two bird limit with stop. But is there any reason for concern out there dwindling numbers?
There's a lot of reason for concern about stop. We are working as a flyway. Us and the Mississippi Flyway particularly have been working with Fish and Wildlife Service and our other flyway partners discussing the SCOP proposal that's been circulating now for several years, in which Fish and Wildlife Service would like to approach a strategy that would reduce the harvest of SCOP by going to a one bird bag limit. And there's a lot of misgivings about that at the flyway level. In terms of going to a one-bird bag on the third or fourth most abundant duck stock we have, and we all realize that it's not harvest; it's an environmental issue on the breeding grounds, and we have encouraged Fish and Wildlife Service, pushed Fish and Wildlife Service, in fact, that to address this problem where it exists and don't try to put it on the backs of the hunters, because people tend to believe that. If you're approach and solving a problem by reducing bag limits or season lengths that are truly environmental problems, you send a signal to the public that it's the hunter and not the real issue. And we're trying to be sure that we don't paint that picture wrongly for our hunters to be accused of sometimes. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman. Vernon, in the South Texas, I guess it's in the special white wing zone, you have the mix of morning white wing and white tip in your limits. Does that pose an enforcement problem?
It has been there for a long, long time, and it has changed a little bit through time. When I first came here in 1993, we had a 10-bird bag in our special white wing zone. That included no more than, I believe, if I remember right, two morning doves and two white tips. During the 90s, we were able to increase that to five morning doves and two white tips. When we initiated this expansion of the special white wing zone, the issue was concern for adding harvest on morning doves by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we agreed to reduce the bag limit to four. So it has generally been enforceable, and the good news is that wherever there is a strong population of white wings, you very seldom see morning doves or white tips in the bag.
Okay.
But they're sort of there for the mistake purposes,
right.
And to add a little recreation. And we've also been able to increase that total daily bag to 10 to 12. So I think we've made some pretty good strides there.
Excuse me one second. One other question on dove is, in falconry, how many people actually hunt dove with
falconry?
I don't know the answer to that question, Commissioner Bivens, but I can look into it and see if I can come up with a number for you, sir.
I found it interesting that we have a category specifically for dove hunters with falcon.
Okay.
Was that a federal requirement, maybe?
Well, falconers get some special privileges within their sport, and I think the daily limit, if I'm remembering right, I hadn't looked at the falcon rules specifically in a long time, but as I recall, the daily limit's three birds.
Correct.
And you know, we don't have enough falconers to hurt anything.
Well, yeah, I was just impressed.
That's
that
a good
idea.
Yeah, there is a group. Yeah.
But I don't know how many falconers specifically pursue doves during the dove season. I would speculate that if anything, the falconry on it affects morning doves occurs late in the framework of the migratory bird season.
I think it's growing in popularity and interest.
I'm sure that this has been asked before, but since I'm new, I'd like to know, is consideration ever given to moving up to the start of North Zone dove season this year, for example, to Saturday because it's the start of the weekend instead of waiting until Monday, because that happens to be September 1st.
It has been asked before.
Almost every year.
And we go through cycles of new commissioners of that. And the answer is the same. The framework for allowing hunting of migratory birds is set in treaty, and it's treaty between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And we cannot start the hunting season for our migratory birds prior to September the 1st.
So it's in the migratory.
And yes, sir. And that's it.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is one just for Ralph for the new one. Where Vernon does a great job because there's so much coordination with the federal Fish and Wildlife, particularly that on all of the migratory. So, and Vernon's done a tremendous job coordinating that and getting our interest, I think, heard. Don't you, Vernon? Mm-hmm. I think Texas does pretty well.
Yeah. We have to be smart with what we take to them.
Yeah. Exactly.
Vernon, just as a clarification on the special white-winged dove area, we're altering the eastern boundary a little bit, right?
No, sir, we're not changing any boundary. We're just altering the first segment of the south zone season to end a week earlier and then move that week into the second segment to end a week later. And this generally accommodates the requests we've been receiving, and we're testing the water to see if this is a change that would be well received or poorly received by our South Zone hunters before we finalize it.
But at the end of next year, will we be able to address that boundary issue?
At the end of next year, if we need to, we can go back and what we would have to do in moving the line, we find is functionally would take about 1 million acres of the special white wing zone out by using the road structures that exist down there to do that. And actually, we just need to see if that's what we need to do, or whether this one change fixes the issue or not. And I think we'll know more about that in 60 days after we get some good public feedback on that. We'll probably have a special public hearing or two down that way to kind of listen to the folks.
Any other questions? Thank you, Vernon.
Thank you.
Okay, no further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item number 4, offshore aquaculture rules. Permission to publish. Mike Ray.
Good morning to fish commissioners. And for the record, my name is Mike Ram. I'm with Coastal Fish Fisheries, and I'm here to talk to you about some offshore aquaculture rules. The commission adopted the offshore aquaculture rules in November of 2006. And since that time, we've been in conversations with some prospective applicants. And as a result, we've come up with some proposed changes to the rules that were presented to this committee in March. And at that time, we were granted permission to go to the Texas Register to try to get public comments on this. And the proposals are procedural in nature and also operational, and there was really no changes that were made that were to the science-based regulations. For an overview of some of the things that we proposed, the permit we're proposing can be issued to an individual, corporation, or Texas-approved business. And right now, the rules say it's just to an individual. And the reason for this change is this takes a lot of money to do these kind of operations, and a corporation is more than likely going to be the folks that are going to be submitting this. And it also helps them to obtain funding if it's situated that way. We're also proposing to give the permit prior to construction, as long as all the other permits are in place and all the conditions of our permit have been met. And again, this is also for to be able to obtain financial backing. It's pretty hard for them to get something if some of the permits are not in place. We also are proposing to extend the time for infrastructure removal to 60 days. This, again, in conversation with the folks, 10 days was an unrealistically short time frame. We also have proposed an appeals process. And this will allow the applicant to request a review of a decision that has been made. Also, there's a geo language update that's more of a house cleaning thing, and I'll be talking a little bit more about that in just a minute. We're also proposing to change the disease condition definition, the 5% mortality in 7 days. Has been removed, and the reasoning for this is this kind of loss is not necessarily due to disease. It can happen, for example, from handling fish, just moving them from one place to another. So in its place, we have added some language that the permittee must send samples to a department-approved aquatic veterinarian within 48 hours should something like this happen. And we also have proposed to expand our options here on what to do should a disease condition occur. And certainly, we can take other appropriate action, and an example of that might be many other diseases can be treated with an approved drug, and that might be a move that we would permit. We did get some public comments. We had 8-4 and 1 against. The one against didn't give a reason. We did get some comments on those that were on the for side by some that requested that we modify the proposed GLGO lease language that to clarify our intent. It was just a little bit clumsy, and we agree we can reword that to make that work. And we request that. That this item be placed on Thursday's agenda for public comment and action. And with that, I'd be happy to entertain any question that you might have.
Sure, Brent.
What happens after the 60-day time frame as far as removal if they don't remove the structure? What rights do we have? Do we require them to put up a bond? Because in many cases, a company like that is probably going to be out of business.
That was certainly a thing that we explored. We, at this point, do not have a bond requirement. I do think that there is some in place from what I saw with the GLO lease. They have a bond, and I think that's what the recourse would be.
Okay. What's the purpose of this vision being on page 168? This is the one that begins a permit under this subchapter other than for an offshore
sea aquaculture facility.
Okay. What we ended up doing here is we did have some rules in place. There are some other provisions that are more applicable to, I think that's what it might be to, like stocking fish for a one-time purpose. Okay, I think this is the. General provision. Okay. The individual only. That is what we're trying to fix. Is we don't want it to be just that anymore. But originally, we had it in place because the law enforcement is a little bit easier to deal with a person. But we can get to it through the corporation by having them list, you know, their various people that would be in charge. I don't know, maybe that's it. Yes.
And is it, there's no residency requirement associated with that?
There, one thing we did add is you do have to have special, you do have to have some sort of a certification that you're a Texas business. You don't have to be here, but you have to have the business requirement to operate in Texas.
Like how many permits do we have outstanding, or how many permits have we issued?
Well, right now there's none. There's one that may be going to happen, but there's none right now.
Okay.
Mike, why don't you just address quickly for the commission that no exotics, in other words, no non-native can be brought in.
No, that's exactly right. They must be native to the Gulf of Mexico, and that's one thing that we will definitely enforce very, very strongly.
Do we have any regulations on where the brute stock can come from?
Yes, we do. And again, they must come from the Gulf of Mexico. And
we're trying to get it moving.
And right now, there's only a handful of folks that probably can produce fish that are in the Gulf.
So they come from the Gulf of Mexico to a hatchery, and then back into the aquaculture facility.
Well, there's several ways it could happen. I think right off the bat, while they're trying to set up their brood stock and get them on cycle to produce, they'll probably try to purchase some from a private vendor somewhere in the Gulf. And there are a few that have been able to raise some species, but not all. And they would probably purchase fingerlings from them and then raise them to a little bit bigger size and then stock them in their cages.
Where do those starter fish?
There's one like in Miami. There's one in Mississippi. There's actually one here in Texas as well for some of the species. So there are a handful of research labs primarily that are associated with universities around the Gulf for the most part is where they're. Where they may come from at first, and then I think what many would do would try to produce their own brood stock, and then try to raise their own. But I think right off the bat, I believe at least the first applicant that's really not there yet, but one that's in the process, I believe they would go ahead and try to buy them from the private sector first.
Mike, are other states doing this?
Right now, we would be the first in the Gulf to do it. There are a couple of other states, and they're kind of going. I don't really remember which ones they are. I believe there's one on the East Coast for sure. I believe there's been some in Maine. In the Northwest, they've done some that's been more like salmon and things like that. But this is we have our own rules. They are mirroring what the federal government is trying to do as well for the Gulf.
What do we see as a timeline for developing this program? I mean, it's obviously we've got to get into a point where we're issuing permits and it starts to become a season program. When does that? What do you see that happening?
You know, I'm not really sure. It's one that I would guess. It would take at least a couple of years of somebody in operation to start getting more skilled at this and proficient. There's certainly markets there. From what my discussions are with others, there's probably not going to be very many people are going to want to do this. So I don't think very many people will do it.
I'm really skittish about this.
one thing to have an onshore fish farming operation where it's totally contained, and if something goes haywire, we can, you know, the product is totally contained.
Mm-hmm.
But having it out there where other fish are interacting with these fish, you know, and Mike, I'm not saying anything about your presentation, your program, your thought process on this, not at all. Yeah, I think you've got all the bases covered. But there may be, instead of first, second, and third, there might be a first, second, third, fourth, fifth base that, you know, that we don't know about. That makes me rather skittish about this. Because of disease, because of walk-offs, how long will a TALO take to get equipment out there to remove this facility? And what are they going to do with the fish that expired within the facility? How quick can they do it? So forth and so on.
I think you raised good questions, and it'd be interesting to know a little bit more about developed programs, successful programs. I don't know, Larry, do we have any kind of benchmarks or analogs to look at with other programs that have developed this aquaculture?
Now, for the record, I'm Dr. Larry McKinney, Director of Coastal Fisheries. As Mike mentioned, there is some facilities in Maine that are doing this, but the most the greatest experience is in Washington, Oregon, and the salmon industry, which has been a kind of a negative learning experience. We've certainly learned some things not to do and to be very careful of. And you mentioned, you hit around the head, Commissioner, disease and genetic issues are of great concern, and that's really why we try to go ahead and get ahead of the game. And we bring these regulations forward in that kind of adaptive management process. We want to put something on the table because this is a new area that we don't know much about. And we've already got our first kind of feedback from the industry side saying, well, this doesn't work for us or that doesn't work for us. And we can make an adaption there. And as we move forward into the science side of it, we'll probably get more input there. A lot of things we just don't know. So the only option is either we just don't do it, or we put a framework out there that we can work with and
right.
feel some confidence in that we can move forward on and see if this can work. Because it can make a contribution, but there are real issues out there that we have to be very careful with. No doubt.
You also see it as a pretty slowly developing program.
I would be surprised within 10 years if we had more than one, if we had that.
Really?
I really think so. I think that it's a lot of risk capital out there to do this. It takes a lot of risk. It's not like the salmon, which is a very well-established industry. It's a whole new deal. We're going to be very strict on the genetics, and getting the stock to start something will take a lot of investment, capital investment, to make sure they can get the stock that we will approve, because we're going to hold them to the same standards we hold our hatcheries to, and it's a very high standard as far as protecting genetic integrity of our native population. So I think it will take some folks with some deep capital looking in the very long term to really get into this in a way that they think they might can make some profit out of it.
So our stance is to establish sort of a broad framework based on the experience that we've heard about and
work our way through that.
Develop, but not spend too much department time on something where we only have potentially one permit issuance.
That's right.
Okay.
We want to provide them a framework to move forward on to try something, but hold them to some pretty high standards.
I just get a little concerned about a program when we think that we might have one in 10 years or 5 years, whether we're spending resources and time on it. I think.
Right. It's a balancing act on that type of thing.
Right.
We've always taken the approach, be it with commercial fisheries or this, is to try to get ahead of that curve, try to set a standard out there that we can work with rather than react to it, which we would have to get ahead of it.
And as John pointed out, there are some potential dangers with it as well. So
yes, sir. There absolutely are.
Yeah.
If we do have one in 10 years, what species would that be?
I'll tell you what, right now, they're looking at a number of different stuff, and it wouldn't just be one, although some have proposed, even like red drum, something that's fairly easy to do first, but...
And that's very likely. The
cobia and stuff like that are most likely to happen. And I will say that these offshore aquaculture facilities have been in other parts of the world for a long time, and some of them have certainly done well.
Okay.
and have been saved.
Thank you. Any other questions?
What other countries?
Some of the Scandinavian countries do an awful lot of salmon. I know they're doing some in South America as well. I believe Peru and a few other places like that are doing it as well.
Okay. Thanks for your presentation, Mike. Appreciate it. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 5, public hunting program update. Dr. Berger and Linda Campbell.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mike Berger, Director of the Wildlife Division. And I'm joined here this morning by Linda Campbell, the Director of our Private Lands and Public Hunting Program. And I just want to say a few words, and I'm going to let Linda take over and present our information. But I just want to thank you for your continuing support of the public hunting program. It's an important activity for us, and we thank for the hunters of Texas as well. And we just wanted to give you an update this morning and let you see the variety of hunting opportunities that our public hunting program offers and how we develop those opportunities on a year-to-year basis. So with that, I'll turn it over to Linda.
All right. Good morning, Commissioners. I'd like to just give you, as Mike said, kind of an overview of our public hunting program, pointing out some of the ways that we look at developing it and addressing opportunities. Last year, TPWD offered public hunting on 43 wildlife management areas, 37 state parks, and 6 other units of public hunting land under our long-term lease agreement. We also hunted 154 properties under short-term leases with private landowners for dove and other small game. In addition, during the 2007-08 season, we provided big game hunts, mostly deer and pronghorn, through contracts with private landowners on 7 properties. Public hunter access is provided by 3 types of permits: the regular or daily permit, our annual public hunting permit, or our walk-in hunting, and our special permit issued for drawn hunts. The regular permit is valid for a single-day hunt on a single area, issued to an individual at the hunt area on the day of the hunt on a first-come, first-served basis. The cost of that permit is $15. Our annual public hunting permit is valid for multiple events on multiple areas during a licensed year, issued to an individual through our licensed vendors, and the cost of that is $48. The third is the special permit, valid for a single hunt period on a single area, awarded to an individual through a drawing conducted at headquarters. The cost, if you're drawn, is $75 or $125, depending on the length of the hunt. Hunt proposals for all of the public hunting lands, including WMA, state parks, and long-term lease or license areas, are requested from state parks and wildlife staff each October. These proposals are collected by headquarters staff in December, and over the next few months are collated, reviewed, and evaluated. After the hunting season dates are set, information from these proposals is used to formulate the applications for drawing booklet, or the drawn hunts book, and the public hunting lands map booklet that provides our walk-in hunting opportunities. Each March through May, Wildlife Division staff seeks and secures hunting lease agreements from private landowners for dove and other small game species. These agreements comprise the hunting areas found in our public dove hunting areas booklet, which is a supplement to our map booklet. What I want to do now is to show you how we implement our public hunting program on areas that serve as our primary research and demonstration areas, compared with areas where public hunting is of the highest priority. So first I'd like to show you the research and demonstration areas. These areas were established to represent the ecological regions of Texas and serve as research venues for that ecological region. Another top priority for these areas is to promote sound resource management through education and demonstration. Staff are assigned to these areas and work with researchers and others to carry out the research and demonstration priorities. These WMAs also provide public hunting, hiking, camping, bird watching, and a host of other recreational opportunities compatible with the habitat management and research and demonstration priorities. Examples of research and demonstration WMAs include the Chaparral, the Kerr, Gus Engeling, Elephant Mountain, and the Matador. What I'd like to do is to run through an example of how activities, including public hunting, are scheduled on our research and demonstration WMAs. We have used the Matador in this example, which is typical of the research and demonstration areas. On the Matador, deer and quail surveys are conducted during September and the first 3 weeks of October. Research activities such as vegetation surveys, radio telemetry and mark recapture studies, bird banding, quail whistle counts, and browse surveys are concentrated during the period of May through August. Habitat management and enhancement work is scheduled at key times during the year. For example, herbicide work is scheduled during the windows of time most appropriate for the control of the target species. Time periods are also planned for working and shipping cattle. Prescribed burning is an important habitat tool, so windows of time are scheduled for this priority activity. Preparations for prescribed burning, such as firebreak maintenance, burning black lines, and other types of preparation, are often done during December and January, working around the planned hunt schedules. Outreach and education is an important priority for the research and demonstration areas. Fall and spring are the busy times for field days, workshops, youth shooting sport events, hunter education workshops, civic groups, and school field trips. Working around all of the research, management, and outreach activities, staff schedules a full agenda of hunting opportunities consistent with habitat management and research goals. As you can see here, the Matador schedule is full during the hunting season with various diversity of hunting opportunities. Another type of WMA we want to show you are those where habitat conservation and public hunting are of highest priority. These areas are more numerous and do not have staff on site. Many are under long-term lease from landowners such as the U.S. Forest Service, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the Sabine River Authority. Like the research and demonstration areas, these lands were established to represent habitats and wildlife populations typical of the ecological region, but with the primary goal of providing public hunting opportunities. Public hunts on all TPWD lands, both WMAs and state parks, are authorized for recreational purposes, for population control to keep animals within the care and capacity of the habitat, and for research purposes. All public use must be biologically sound, promote conservation of the resource, adequately address public safety, and be compatible with other priority uses. Granger Wildlife Management Area is one of the areas where public hunting is of highest priority. As you can see, the area is open most of the year for various types of walk-in hunting, and this is typical of our areas in this category. Now I'd like to provide some data on the history of the public hunting program, including acreages in the program, permit sales, and costs for leasing private lands.
What is APH?
Annual public hunting.
Oh, okay. That's good.
The annual public hunting permit program began in 1987 to provide hunters with affordable walk-in hunting opportunity. Sales have fluctuated over the years, as you can see here. There have been two price increases since the program began. One was in 1996 with a fee increase from $35 to $40. Although there was a slight decrease in sales following the fee increase, sales rebounded quickly. The second price increase in 2003 from $40 to $48 resulted in a sharper decline in permit sales, which has only recently stabilized. We are still selling APH permits for 08, at the present time we are up about 5.4% in sales over last year.
And how was it? Sorry to give you around. 07, yes. It doesn't show 07. Was 07 flat with 06, or was it starting to rise again?
Yes, this actually the 06 is the beginning of the hunting season, so this is actually 06, 07.
Okay, gotcha.
07, 08, we're still selling and didn't, but we're up 5.4%, yes, sir, at this point. About 31,000 permits is about what that is, what that represents.
And your max year was 45,000, looks like in 01.
Yep. Regarding our walk-in hunting program again, APH, we increased the number of acres for the first 10 years and have leveled off since 1997. We've lost acreage in recent years due to the loss of lands in the program belonging to private timber companies in East Texas. We've tried to compensate for this by increasing the number of acres in our small game lease program by going to the private sector. We began our draw hunt program in 1954 by drawing 75 hunters to hunt deer at the Kerr Wildlife Management Area. This chart shows the last 9 years of history. You will note that even with a slight drop in applications resulting from a $2 to $3 application fee increase in 2003, applications have been steadily climbing in our draw program. The popularity of our draw hunt seems to be gaining as we continue to offer a diversity of opportunities to choose from. For example, last year we offered a pronghorn hunt on private land that drew lots of applications. And this year we'll offer 3 pronghorn hunts on private land. Considering the number of permits offered for drawn hunts, we have held fairly steady at around 6,000 permits since 1999. Weather-related events affect the number of permits we offer. For example, you can see the dip after Hurricane Rita in 2004. Our short-term dove lease program began in 1994 with 10 leases. Since that time, we've expanded the program to include more areas and a diversity of small game. We increased the number of leases dramatically from 1994 through 1999 and have held fairly steady at around 150 leases. The constraints on growing the program are field staff time to negotiate the leases with landowners and money to pay for them. The acreages leased through the small game lease program has leveled off at about 55,000 to 60,000 acres since 2002. You might notice this outlier in 2001 was the result of a very large property in West Texas leased for a minimal cost. We found out that the use by hunters was not good, and it was subsequently dropped from the program. The cost to secure these leases continues to rise and tends to track rising lease costs in the private sector. This shows the average cost per acre to lease lands for small game hunting. The cost per acre is rising and is increasing faster in certain areas of the state, for example, South Texas and Central Texas. Again, our lease negotiations are affected by the average lease prices in the various regions of the state. The potential for growth in the public hunting program lies primarily in expanding opportunities to cooperate with private landowners to lease their lands for public hunting. We'd like to focus on increasing the number of small game leases on private lands, increasing the number of agreements with landowners interested in working with us to achieve their population management goals by offering big game hunting through our public draw system. And we also want to continue to maximize hunting opportunities on WMAs and state parks, consistent with research demonstration and other recreational uses. Finally, I'd like to show you this map of the locations of our small game leases during the 2007-08 hunting season. We target properties within a 2 to 3 hour drive of high population areas, which you see those in the hatching, and those near major transportation corridors. And this map shows the location of the properties providing big game hunts to the public hunting program in the 07-08 season. We are working to grow this program as well, with the major constraint being funding. And with that, answer any questions you might have.
Yes, sir, Brown.
I'm assuming as far as private landowners, you know, donating or making their property available, there's always the issue of liability. And I am wondering, is there a way that we, through legislation, could have some form of limited liability, unless it was just gross negligence or something like that, that would encourage more landowners to make their property available for these, you know, public kinds?
That has been suggested, Commissioner. And I, at this point, the liability is basically Chapter 75, which is what all landowners are covered under, which caps liability. But there has been discussion of that issue, and I do think it would be beneficial.
Would you expound on that, what the discussion part?
Well, just as he says, if there would be some way that landowners who work with the state in providing opportunities for public hunting could have some benefit in liability coverage above what is available now, I think it would be a benefit.
Let me just say, Chapter 75, I believe, offers caps their liability at $1 million if you do not exceed, I believe it's 20 times the ad valorem tax on that property. And that's for anyone, regardless of whether they're in public hunting program or not. And unless I'm mistaken, that's never been tested or challenged or anything. So, and that has been brought up as a concern, that whether it would really hold up. But if we could do something additional for public, those people who are involved in offering opportunities on their private land for public hunting, that would be an additional incentive to join with us.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, I think that our public hunting program is great, but we all know sitting here around this table that it has got to be expanded to keep up with our surging population, especially in the metropolitan areas. If hunting licenses sales are going to at least in some way track the growing population of the state. And for my part, I think that we should throw the throttle wide open in within this area, start thinking about it, how can we do it, what do we need to do to become even more forceful in our thought process than we already are, because we have just got to increase this area of public.
I agree with you, John, and staff has spent a lot of time. Linda's done a great job, Mike. I agree with you. We also, you know, I think it'd be helpful just to talk for a few minutes about the website and the, because if you look at it, it's channels. We've got the APH and the other one, and then the third significant one is how we get people together through the through the website. And you guys have done great work with that, but I don't know if you can just spend a couple of minutes describing that and the growth of it and so forth.
I'd be happy to. It's called Hunt Texas Online Connection. It's been rolled out to landowners now for a number of months. We have, at last count, I think 160, somewhere exceeding 160 leases, leasing opportunities listed by landowners. The idea, of course, is to put something on our website that would get landowners seeking hunters connected with hunters seeking opportunity as a public service to both constituencies. And we are working right now on outreach to hunters now to try to let them know that this is an opportunity for them to seek, you know.
And that's a big focus area for us over the next year, isn't it?
Yes.
Do we have a sense of what the hits are on that side? Has it increased over the last, you know?
Well, we haven't really rolled it out to the hunters as much as we are going to over the next few months. Landowners, though, we have a number sign up. We sent a letter to all lease license holders, and that prompted lots of sign up. So that was a good deal.
This one?
Yeah.
I also don't want to get away from John's point, which is a good one, is that we've got, you know, increasing urbanization. We need to make sure that we can grow this program and grow hunting opportunity close to urban areas, particularly. And I agree that it's somewhat of a significant opportunity, somewhat of a crisis for us if we don't, because of the potential decline in interest in the outdoors. Something that we've got to address in our strategic planning process.
I really think the liability issue, if there was a way to deal with that, I think it would make a huge impact on making additional property.
Do you run into that much when you're trying to lease short-term lease property?
They ask about it, but again, we go back to giving them copies of the Chapter 75 caps, which is about all we can do at this point.
And just to clarify, I mean, I think everybody here knows, but in order to do what Commissioner Brown is talking about, getting something additional, that's a statutory change. It's necessary. It's not a commission action.
Yeah.
Right.
Another question, too, getting to John's point about, well, right now we're spending, let's say, $250,000 on short-term lease costs per year. What if we double what? You know, we go to legislation and we double that money. Can you get the leases?
It would help because we would have more money to negotiate with landowners, but our pinch point then becomes field staff time to find the landowners and negotiate the leases. That's always been a constraint because they have to get out there and find the people to work with.
So personnel issues,
yes,
going out and finding the leases.
Yes.
When some of us were younger, I think you found a piece of land you wanted to go hunt, and you went down the road and found the farmhouse or the ranch house, and there's a guy that owned it. Now you find a piece of land that looks likely, and there's nobody there, and you got to go to the courthouse and find out who owns the land, where he lives, make contact. It's a lot more complicated process to get these contracts.
If you don't mind me saying, we are exploring ideas of partnerships to try to piggyback on perhaps some other organizations like Soil and Water Conservation Districts, others that are out there.
Oh, yeah, okay.
They're
out there all the time.
And
that's a good idea.
Like try that. To pursue some of that and see if maybe we could extend our reach.
I think we're willing to ask for more dollars. The key is, because I've run into this, I'm asking this question kind of be rhetorical, is that one of our issues is just personnel and people. We all want to increase this public hunting, but it's going to take more manpower. I mean, whether it's on WMAs or whether it's in these short-term leases, finding them or whatever. So.
And we can advertise and get people to come to us. Mm-hmm. We've done some of that, but it's still that personal touch that it's going to take to sign folks up for this.
Commissioner Duggins.
Well, that's the point I want to come to. You say if there's a shortage of field staff to work on the acquisition of the properties, is it feasible to ask the game wardens who tend to have good local relationships to provide at least refer opportunities or actually get involved and help there or not?
Yes, sir, and that has been done. And Mr. Cook certainly wanted that to occur. And we do have some game wardens that, one particularly in the Panhandle that has got 17 leases, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, he signed up a bunch of people. So if we could get more game warden input, that would be great for us.
That's a real good point. Maybe even potentially creative.
Those game wardens don't have enough to do they?
Yeah.
A big beat back here going, maybe, okay.
Commissioner Parker. Yeah,
that's exactly what I was. I'll just piggyback on what Commissioner Duggins talked about with the game wardens. And, you know, no one is closer to the landowners within DPWD than our game wardens.
Right.
Those guys are closer to the landowners and more confidence in those people. And if we could just look at sitting down and beginning to really think that
I think we've just scratched the surface of this. If it takes more budget, see Commissioner Brown.
Mr. Finance, right?
He can make money. But I think this is an area that warrants top attention. And not that you all have done a wonderful job in getting this thing off the ground, but now we need to get it above treetop height.
I agree, and you know, in my experience, the only way to make that happen is to establish a goal and a time frame for it, and say this is where we want to be to grow this program. It's important, it's vital, it's consistent with our mission, it's the backbone of our mission, and we need to establish a goal and a time frame for it, and then work back from there and make it happen. And that's why it should be a big component of the strategic planning process that comes out of our natural agenda.
And you know, not only private lands, but begin to think about how we can utilize the lands we already own. For instance, Big Bend Ranch State Park, Aladoro, where expanding that acreage up there.
Creative ways within the systems that we already have.
Sure.
And the last comment I would make about that, and I'm going to get to Commissioner Bivens, who's been waiting patiently, is that I'd encourage everyone to look at the website and to provide feedback. The staff's worked very hard on it, and I think it's a great program, and it's going to have to, our goals are going to have to be fueled by a strong marketing program.
Yes.
And so I'd encourage everyone to look at that and to provide feedback, and I think that's going to be a great avenue for growth for us.
I just have a process question. For instance, a remote tract of land that's under private ownership is leased as a public hunting venue for quail hunting. Is it the game warden's responsibility to take these hunters to that property? I mean, I'm not saying physically take them there, but is he going to be, if it's a locked gate, for instance, is he going to be the one responsible for opening that gate, or is the landowner going to be the one responsible?
Yes, sir, I understand. That would be a walk-in hunting under our annual public hunting, is what you're describing would fit into. Our field staff mark those areas as public hunting fields with signs. We put a map with all the details of that property in our Dove supplement book. So when you buy your $48 permit from a licensed vendor, you also get that book. And so then it's up to the hunter, you know, with all the directions to use that book to find his way to that property. And so that property is unlocked, I mean, is available for hunters to use during that period of time that's in the book.
And so if there's two different groups that want to hunt, they have some sort of priority sign-up privilege or something like that, or do they have to work that out among themselves?
In that program, it's walk-in to everybody who holds the permit. So there is sometimes there's an on-site registration box where people do sign in. But it is
walk-in hunting for all comers that are there, and there shouldn't be anything locked or that anybody has to make a special opening for or accompany anybody to hunt.
The landowner gets paid a per acre lease cost for opening that land for hunting, walk-in hunting for a certain period of time for certain species.
I'm trying to go through the mechanics of the process.
I think what you may be talking about, if I'm listening right, it may be an opportunity to work into some drawn hunting programs.
Right.
So if you were doing under the drawn hunt and not the APH, the annual hunting permit, what you're talking about might be possible, where somebody, the landowner, could accompany the hunters, could schedule the hunts at different times. And that might
also
be
just to keep people from being right on top of one another.
Right.
Creating a potentially dangerous situation when you have two hunting groups on the same property, and one may not know the other one's even there.
There's usually a check-in area, though, a designated parking area, so generally you know who else is there because everybody enters the same way. Yeah.
Let me just provide one more bit of information before we leave this. On the Hunt Texas Online, some of you, I think all of you, received letters from a individual or two who is concerned about this program competing with them or injuring their business, and just wanted to make you aware that there are some people who are doing this on a commercial basis who have expressed some concerns. We are meeting with those individuals and try to work that out. Also on that website are listed all of the commercial websites that we are aware of that do engage in that for profit. So the people who visit that website are not limited just to us, but that information on the other sites is made available for them. But we think this is an additional service to individuals, not a competitive arrangement.
I wanted to go back to the liability insurance issue. And is there a specific product that is available for owners to buy for this particular item, or is it just general liability insurance that is normally purchased for this?
I believe it's just general liability, whatever the landowner has to cover his property. And
there are additional products and you know, excess liability types of products. I'm certainly no expert in that area, but there are ways that owners can protect themselves from that type of liability.
And is the concern that the cap has not been tested? Is that what you mentioned earlier?
I don't believe that the cap has been tested in a courtroom situation, and that is a concern that's been expressed to me on an occasion.
I wanted to bring up, there was an interesting, avenue on this public hunting. But it was geared more towards the youth hunt. Last week there were several articles in the Bernie paper that were talking about having youth hunts possibly in the state, in the city
county
park.
County parks, yeah.
Yeah. Because I thought that was an interesting way of approaching overpopulation of deer, and it was already kind of game proof and or game fenced, and I thought that was kind of an interesting avenue, and I don't know if they...
Well, I can add to that, Commissioner. We are working with two cities now, Kerrville and perhaps Bernie, regarding bringing some of those parks into the public hunting program under our private lands program. In other words, we pay per hunt position for certain animals that they would like to have removed for population control. And so that pays them for closing these parks. And so that's kind of how we're handling that. Now there's the Texas Youth Hunting Program also. And so we're kind of approaching it from both angles. They're providing some opportunity for Texas Youth Hunting Program, and they're working with our public hunting program under our private lands hunts to handle those city and county parks, I guess.
Yeah. That was an interesting angle.
Have you had any problems with landowners dropping out of the lease program because of abuses or circumstance that Mark was talking about, where you had too many hunters on one property at one time?
We have landowners in and out of this program, and really it was established just to get people started in leasing land. I mean, many go on to lease in the private sector, and that's fine. As long, you know, I mean, we get them started, and they move on, and they begin to lease privately. The land is still open for hunting. So we oftentimes get people just kind of entering this arena of leasing land for hunting. Many stay. Some move on to the private sector. Then we get new ones in. So we get in and out. We do have a multi-year contract now where we can renew with mutual consent for a couple of years. So we are working that angle so that we don't have to renegotiate every year. Upon mutual agreement, we can actually renew these leases.
Okay. But have you had landowners drop out and tell you, I'm not going to do it anymore because of this abuse? I'm just curious what the abuses are.
We have had some problems, yes. I mean, any time you have that, I mean, gates being left open, you know, trash, you know, things like that happen on public hunting lands, and yes, we have those occur.
I would say that's rare.
Off and on. It's fairly rare.
I wouldn't want to characterize that as a frequent or common.
We try to be very clear in our books that the public hunter is a guest on private land, and if they don't conduct themselves as guests, that we will lose that opportunity. And so we try to be very clear that we like people to conduct themselves in a manner that they would be welcome. So.
Over time, as the program grows, hopefully we can establish some protocols and procedures that, you know, there's always going to be those examples. We're going to have to deal with that. But, of course, that's going to require resources.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mr. Brown?
He says no problem.
No problem.
You're like Santa Claus. Carter. The two pads of the pod. Yeah, right.
I think what we're all saying is that it's a program that needs to expand. It's we need to develop it. It's vital to our mission, and and we've got to establish some parameters, a time frame for it, and also some goals in terms of how we handle it with requests from the legislature and so forth. Any other questions?
I want to add, I like your suggestion of setting some goals or some potential goals, for example, where they're holes geographically in this map,
right,
west of Tarrant County, just to pick where I live, and out where Shackelford County and Stevens County. I mean, I think there should be a lot of opportunities there.
Right.
Come back to the relationships that I know most of the landowners have with your game board, and they're good ones, so I think it's a good potential source of.
Other questions? Thank you. That was great.
Appreciate
your effort. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think you're hearing the interest of the commission, so we'll focus on this relative to going into the legislature too. And so I think help us with what kind of resources you're going to need. You know, whether it's dollars for leases or it's dollars for personnel to help us oversee this in some form or fashion, it might be an increased effort.
Yes, sir. We'll do that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I think you're up next.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
All right, Public Lands Proclamation.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, my name is Linda Campbell, again, Wildlife Division Program Director for Private Lands and Public Hunting. Today I'll brief you on the proposed changes to regulations governing the public hunting for 2008-2009. The first item is rulemaking affecting the Public Lands Proclamation. Second item is establishment of annual open season on public hunting lands. And the third is approval of public hunting activities on units of the state park system for the 2008-2009 season. Excuse me. At the March meeting of the Regulations Committee, staff was authorized to publish proposed amendments to the Public Lands Proclamation in the Texas Register for public comment. Those amendments would create a mentored hunting permit and fee and waive the access fee requirement for spectators at field dog trials held on wildlife management areas. The mentored hunting permit would allow TPWD to hold weekend educational workshops targeting hunter recruitment on wildlife management areas. A mentored hunt would be held for participants following the workshop. Field staff are in the process of planning an event targeting new hunters to be held on the Justin Hurst WMA in September. Just wanted to let you know that as well. We received very little public comment on the proposed rules. Six people supported the proposal to create the mentored hunting permit, and four people opposed the proposal. Eight people supported the proposed fee of $25, and three people opposed it. Two people offered a specific reason for their opposition. One person felt that there should be no fee,
and one person felt that the fee should be the same as the APH permit, which is $48. And no other public comment was received.
On the opposed up above, any particular comments?
No, sir. No, all the comments were on the fee. So. Under Parks and Wildlife Code, Chapter 81, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission may prescribe an open season for hunting on public hunting lands. This is done on an annual basis, and the season is year-long. The commission also annually approves a list of specific hunting activities to take place on units of the state park system during the year. Those activities are located at Exhibit C of this item. Staff request that this item be placed on Thursday's agenda for public comment and action by the full commission. That answers any questions.
Mr. Park.
Going back to the hunting on state parks, how many state parks do we allow?
This year, we've got our proposals in, 41 total.
41
total.
Is that an increase?
Yes, by two.
Okay.
Up by two this year.
Going the right way then.
Yes. Okay. And we're up 167 hunt positions from last year.
Okay.
Just on state parks, Linda, or as a whole?
Just on state parks.
Okay.
Yes, sir. 167.
167 what?
Hunt positions.
Hunt positions.
Yes.
There will be 167.
No, we're up 167 compared with last year's number of hunt positions.
What would be your total number then?
Total number for this upcoming season, excuse me, is 1,795.
State parks.
State parks.
And how do you get? Are you getting that word out? I mean, I know I keep asking that question. I might get tired of it, but
getting.
Well, I mean, in the past, remember one of the things that I've felt is we're not doing enough outreach to really let people know that these state parks are available, these slots are available. And, I mean, is there anything you've added? Any more outreach relative to these?
Well, these
to state park and just public hunting overall.
You know, these go in our draw book. These are our drawn hunts for state parks, so we put those in our drawing book. I don't know otherwise how we, I mean, press releases and things like that when we talk.
Our website?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I have another question. What about the larger state parks, such as Big Bear Ranch State Park, Conodoro,
Well, we have 35 parks have drawn hunts, and then walk-in hunting is offered on 11 of them, and Big Bend Ranch is one of those.
Well, walk-in.
Walk-in meaning they buy the $48 annual public hunting permit, and then it's walk-in hunting, and we have 11 parks that are doing that as well. As 35 that are holding drawn hunts.
Caladuro.
Let's see. Caladuro. No? Okay. The walk-in hunts are on...
Is there any reason why we don't Caladuro
at 1,600 slots, whatever?
Sure.
So we have about 5,000 people.
I believe they are. I believe they're included in the drawn hunts. I think Caladuro is offering drawn hunts. They are not. Okay.
Is there any particular reason why?
I think they're assessing their game populations. I mean, we get the proposals in from the staff that justify the public hunting, and at this point.
We ask for those proposals every year, and there's Walt and our staff are doing an assessment of the public hunting, of what kind of opportunities might be available there. And that assessment is still ongoing. Correct.
So the assessment will not come in time for us to make the deadline?
Not for this year.
Not for this year, yeah.
Commissioner Parker, there's some new property, you know, that's been added to the canyon that would provide excellent hunting opportunity, but it's so new in the system, I think it's going to take some time to fully digest the usage patterns and also due to the high amount of pedestrian traffic in that park, you've got to be very careful on where you do allow hunting.
We do have walk-in hunting in 11 state parks, though, and, throughout the system.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Mr. Chairman, we've completed our business.
Wow. We did pretty well with old regs, didn't we?
Yeah.
Okay, we will move into the Finance Committee. That's the gavel to Chairman Brown. You're up.
The first order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval? Mr. Martin? Second. Mr. Friedkin, second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Committee item number one is the land and water plan update. Mr. Smith.
Right. Thank you, Chairman. Just a couple of things I want to visit with you all about. One, I want to remind everybody that it's our turn to go through the sunset review process. This will be a very important process for the agency as a whole. The Sunset Commission this year is being chaired by Representative Carl Isaac from Lubbock, and the vice chair is Senator Glenn Hager from Katy. We have our entrance level meeting with Sunset Commission staff next week, at which point they'll kind of be laying out their timeline, expectations, site visits, as well as setting up dates to meet with all of our division directors and likely to come and speak with all of you. So just a heads up that process is starting, and it will be a busy time for us this summer as we work with the Sunset team and all of our partners and constituent groups out there across the Texas landscape. I want to let everybody know that about a month ago, Chairman Brown and I and staff had an opportunity to visit with the Senate Finance Committee. They asked us to come speak to the committee about the progress on our management and expenditure of funds for state parks. Ms. Tina Beck from Legislative Budget Board, who is here today with us. Hi, Tina. Preceded us and gave the committee a really good baseline of the appropriations that had gone to state parks. We entertained a number of questions from the committee just regarding our management of the capital projects, our plans for getting things expended in a timely and efficient manner, and also we had some questions as well about some game warden related things on Homeland Security. But overall, I thought it was a very, very good discussion. I think we got pretty good feedback afterwards, and Chairman, appreciate your joining us for that as well. I want to talk a little bit about some of the budget riders that came with our appropriations in this biennium. A number of them had fairly significant fiscal implications for the agency, and so I want to talk about three of them. Rider 27 in the appropriations bill allows us, with approval from the comptroller, to be able to utilize additional revenue that we generate above and beyond our biennial revenue estimate. For this fiscal year, that estimate that we have come up with for state parks is about $5.7 million above and beyond what we originally estimated. About $4.3 million of that is additional fees that our state parks team will likely generate through access to state parks. And then we are expecting to generate about $1.6 million in additional fees through our Fund 9 programs. And the comptroller has certified those funds. We will look now to expend those this fiscal year, and we'll be working with the oversight agencies, including the Legislative Budget Board, to let them know how we will spend those funds. Rider 29 was an additional budget rider that had $8.8 million in appropriations for our state parks. It was contingent upon us making satisfactory progress with the state auditor's office on the implementations of their recommendations. The state auditor's office had approved $4.4 million in being expended in the fall with the Legislative Budget Board. We received approval from the LBB and the state auditor's office last month that we'd be able to access the remaining $4.4 million, so we feel good about that. And then last but not least, very, very pleased with respect to Rider 30, which was another rider which addressed getting approval from the Legislative Budget Board to be able to sell the $44 million in bond funds to help pay for our major improvements at state parks. We received that approval yesterday from the Legislative Budget Board, and so we will now work with the Texas Public Finance Authority and the Bond Review Board to sell those bonds. We expect those to be sold in the process sometime in August, I believe, and then we'll be able to utilize those to start investing in the major repairs in the state parks that the legislature helped support our efforts. We are still waiting on approval for the funds for Battleship Texas. That's a contingent, though, upon an engineering feasibility study that we expect to complete sometime in the end of June. Scott, I think that's right. And so at that time, the end of this month, okay,
yes,
end of May. And so we'll look for hopefully approval on that front sometime in June. So anyway, all is well on that front, and appreciate the work with the Legislative Budget Board to help us with all of these budget matters. So thank you, Tina, and your team over there. Last but not least, I think that the chairman wanted to have a discussion about an item that we had talked very, very briefly about at the last commission meeting, and that is a proposal that we are interested in bringing forward about potentially moving perhaps one commission meeting a year somewhere out in the state to be able to interact more with different stakeholders around the state, give folks a chance to come to the commission meetings and visit with y'all in other locations besides Austin. We had tentatively proposed that maybe we consider moving the August commission meeting to Houston. That is obviously the meeting in which we get or open it up for public input. And so again, the goal is, how do we maximize that? How do we give opportunities for folks around the state to do that? And so I know that we wanted to have a discussion about kind of the pros and cons of that. And so let me just open it up there to get some feedback from y'all on that front.
Yeah, let me speak to it. And I may have gotten a little ahead of myself because it's something I've been considering a couple of years, and I probably should have thrown out to everybody first. But, you know, obviously our constituency is all in Austin, Texas. And particularly as I went through the legislative process last legislature, in our major metropolitan areas, Houston, Dallas, and not to say we wouldn't eventually, in my opinion, should go other places, but the urban legislator definitely, how to put this right, once the legislative period starts, which will be January 09, the pressure on them and the focus on them is obviously from their own constituents within that urban area. And there's not a lot of understanding or even connection to Texas Parks and Wildlife, for obvious reasons. And so one of my ideas was is that we take a meeting to them, more or less, and their constituents. And so Dan Friedman and I talked about it, and we felt Houston was a good place to start. It could have been Dallas, it could have been San Antonio, for that matter, or elsewhere. But definitely go where we as a commission show those legislators, show their constituents, that you know, we do believe in reaching out to their urban population. Because we talk about it a lot. We talk about it here in Austin, but we're not sitting in front of those constituents in their own cities. And so I felt strongly it's important to have them. I think one way to do that, to show a commitment, is to actually show up in their city and have a series of meetings and do the normal two-day meeting just like we do here. So that's where the thought process came from. I'm certainly willing to take the input on it, but I do feel strongly about it, so I do want to put that out there.
Excellent idea. Let's move forward.
I know Mark has a question.
Have we put a pencil to what this might cost?
That's a good question, Commissioner. We have not formally quantified that. I mean, I think we can and will do that. I mean, we certainly recognize we're going to have additional travel costs and room setup costs and some expense there. Our just sort of back of the envelope perspective on that was that the benefits by being in those communities and more outwardly facing would more than compensate for those. But we can quantify that and make sure that the commission has a realistic understanding of what those additional costs will be. We'll get that to you.
But I think some of it can be offset. For example, I think the Houston Zoo wants to help us. And so, you know, there's ways that we can work with the local groups that we work with on an ongoing basis to help offset some of those costs.
And then if... Are we potentially
setting a precedent that we're going to be committing to do this indefinitely?
I hope so. From my point of view, yes.
And then if so, are we risking getting negative feedback from, say, El Paso or, I mean, just pick a city that we haven't been to, and say we go to the major metropolitan areas first? I'm just trying to anticipate any sort of
unintended consequence.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And
yes, we may get some of that kind of pressure, but I think, you know, if you explain to any reasonable individual what you're trying to do is do this to outreach to the constituency that doesn't just live in Austin, Texas. I mean, our public meetings are great, and I love them, but the fact is, primarily, we get people either from Austin or we get, you know, sports writers or whatever. This will give the public an opportunity to be able to, in their own hometown, be able to at least maybe once a year, and I'm not necessarily talking about doing any more than that, to have a chance. And then you figure out a rotation, or you don't necessarily even figure a rotation. You just, you know, maybe if there's a major issue in one of the urban areas or whatever, you go to your constituents. So
right.
That was my thought process.
What would you evaluate, like, each, or would we evaluate each year maybe to determine where it might be important
that
for us to be?
That certainly may make sense. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Good idea. You know, I hadn't considered the regulatory cycle impact or benefit, I guess, in terms of when we have the meeting, but one question I had was, you know, should we make it a different meeting in our year, in our cycle, than the big meeting, the meeting where everyone...
Public meeting in August.
The public
yeah.
meeting, yeah.
So that everyone has equal opportunity in that public meeting.
And then possibly pick a different meeting to have it as our
yeah,
outreach.
And that may make sense in the next round. I was just looking at the timing thing because of this year.
And we have a legislative...
Yeah, and we have a legislative agenda coming up, so I don't think the commission is locked into it. It has to be every August. I'm not certainly not
right.
saying that. You know, I just kind of wanted to get it started, to be blunt. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I think this is a terrific idea.
Okay.
And, you know, to overcome what Commissioner Bivens brought up about when are we going to El Paso, you know, when are you coming to Lufkin? Speak to that. You know, you and Carter sit down and you make a list.
Mm-hmm.
The first one's going to be here, and the 18th one is going to be there.
Well, I want to be careful. Yeah, but I don't want to lock it.
Want to string it out. But I think once you set a precedent, I think future commissions will see the advantage of going to the people, and it will become a precedent.
Right. Well, and I hope so. I don't think it'd be, at least in my case, not going to be Carter, because obviously I won't be around that long to lock in the commission 5 years from now.
Well,
I understand what your point is. I think maybe we make a commitment as a commission. If we do this, let's do this one time, see if it works and we think it's appropriate and worthwhile, see what kind of feedback we get on it. And then maybe as a commission we just make a commitment that we're willing to do this once a year. We don't lock into any one place and maybe rotate if there's issues going on in some part of the state or whatever. So,
maybe
it's a marvel site.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
just in thinking about this, I had one other idea which I'll just share for the purpose of sharing only. But we could have a different category of meeting in these other cities. They would not be one of our five scheduled meetings. They would be a separate meeting that would be solely for the purpose of a public forum. And those meetings may not necessarily have a quorum of commissioners at them. If we did not have to have a quorum, that would simplify the meeting process considerably. But it would still show our intent to reach out to the public and still allow the public to communicate with us. It just might not necessarily be in front of all my commissioners.
Right. No. I mean, those are all legitimate ways to approach it, and I certainly don't doubt that. But I've just watched UT Board of Regents and others, and they're willing to move around. And I think you know, as Texas Parks and Wildlife, we do business in all counties, all cities. I mean, we're truly a statewide agency. And so
that's true.
It seems to me there is some opportunity.
Just the money. I mean, we're doing everything in our power to try to improve our parks and to try to improve our infrastructure within what we're governing. And I don't want to use dollars that could go to that to, you know, create a new financial burden. But it may not be that expensive.
No, it won't be that expensive.
I don't think it will.
I don't see it being. I don't know. I'm a little nervous about throwing out a number, but my guess is you're talking about less than $5,000. I think we can get a lot of sponsors. In other words, I don't think we'll end up having to pay a room fee and those things. Now, yes, some people can have hotel rooms and those kind of things, but I don't think we're talking about big dollars here, personally.
I think that's right. I think it's going to be the travel and other incidental costs.
Yeah.
For instance, in August, the Houston Zoo has offered up their meeting rooms free of charge. I mean, they're thrilled and ecstatic to have the department there. They've been a great conservation partner, and so I think we look for those kind of opportunities where we could leverage a partnership and certainly try to get that space donated to us to help mitigate any increase in costs. But
can you say that Commissioner Friedman's house?
Yes, he offered his own.
He offered
right there. And on the other side, if we're trying to do something maybe in the evening, and maybe we get some of our but anyway, get some friends to help offset that cost, do some evening outreach or something. So we're already digging into all of that. Yeah, no, I understand your point. I think it's a legitimate point. Is our job is to try to lessen the cost as much as possible if we're going to be willing to try this.
Sure.
Yeah.
Definitely worth trying.
Good. Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate everybody. And I think, you know, everybody can get to Houston probably as easily as they can get to Austin. I'm talking about the commission anyway, so. But I think it'd be a good outreach, and it kind of reaches out. Obviously, we're not in Lufkin, but it reaches out to East Texas too. And so we go to that area, and you know, that's my thought process anyway. Is, you know, how do we do a better job of reaching out to the regions that, you know, obviously have a great interest, or certain groups have great interest in what we're doing, instead of always asking everybody to come to Austin.
I can get to Houston.
You can get to Houston. They can get to Houston.
I can find it.
Okay, so I think we've got the feedback then that, Chairman, you want us to go ahead and proceed with the August meeting then in Houston?
Please.
And we'll give that a try and see how that goes, and we will quantify those costs that we'll
start
with that and make sure we're able to talk about those, and then we'll evaluate it accordingly just to see if it's a success we hope it to be. So, okay.
Yeah, and if anything dramatic comes up, obviously we'll back off this. We haven't publicly announced this or anything. Now, obviously, it's not in public record that we're looking into it, and I'm certainly willing to talk about that openly. But, you know, let's now dig into all the detail. I appreciate everybody's input. And if something pops up that just makes it unfeasible or too expensive, whatever, no, I'll be glad to back off.
Sure. Okay. Just don't want to commit us to something we can't afford to.
Right. No, absolutely, Mark. Good point.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm done. Good. Thank you. Yeah, appreciate the feedback from everybody. Thank you all.
Committee item number two is the financial overview of Gene Sparnett. And I believe Julie Horsley will outreach.
That's where I would get his input.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Gene McCarty. I'm Deputy Executive Director for Administration. Chief Financial Officer Mary Fields couldn't be with us this morning because of personal illness, and so I make a poor substitute. But with your with your patience, we'll make it through this, and hopefully we'll be able to give to you the information that you need for this commission meeting's financial overview. Within our financial overview this morning, we're going to cover three main areas. First being just a review of the revenue and budget status for FY08 as it stands as of March 31st. Julie Horsley with me here today will give you kind of an update on our FY09 to FY13 strategic plan. And then I'll follow up with giving you kind of an update on the FY10, FY11 legislative appropriation request, or the LAR. To start with, we'll do the standard revenue and budget status review. And if We'll start with state park receipts. You'll notice that state park receipts as of March 31st were up $17.8 million, which is about 10.2% or $1.65 million over this same time in 2007. The principal areas of increase were in park entrance fees and facility use fees. Boat registration and titling revenue was down about 0.7%. It represents about $8.47 million total collection to date. We were down about $61,000 over prior year, and this is principally in the registration category, boat registration category. It's almost down 5% over prior year. This probably is a reflection of the current situation in the economy and fuel costs. And we will continue to watch this closely as we get into the summer. License sales revenue, this is our hunting and fishing license sales revenue, at the end of March was up by 2.4%, representing about $75.8 million or up $1.8 million total. This is we were up in almost all categories except for resident hunting, which was only very slightly down. Total license sales is up up 5.2%, representing a total of 2.35 million licenses sold. As I said, the only down area is in total hunting at about 0.6%. It represents resident hunting down at 1.5%. Total fishing was up 8.4%.
The boat registration is off.
Boat registration is off, but fishing is up.
Yeah.
Fish from the bank.
There's a lot of fishing.
I mean, I understand you can fish from a lot of
there's a lot of fishing from the bank.
But it'd be interesting. I mean, it's kind of fascinating that it's that. I mean, you're down, and this is actually up quite a bit. Yeah.
There's a tremendous amount of fishing that's not directly related to boating. Yeah. Or there's a tremendous amount of boating that's not directly related
well,
to fishing.
Well, good point.
A lot of just pleasure boating that goes on that's burning a lot of fuel that they're probably not going to want to burn right now. And combo sales are up about 3%. We believe if you look at combo sales being up at 3%, we don't really think that hunting itself is down. I think we're seeing a shift in the market as we continue to have increased number of stamps and so forth. We're shifting people out buying just a hunting license to buying the combo, and really that's a good thing in the overall revenue strategy. If you look at revenue collected to date, with 58% of the year elapsed, we've collected 75% of our total revenue, or 75% of our total Fund 9 revenue, 58% of our total Fund 64 revenue, 63% of our local park revenue, and 116% of other. Principally, the other is driven by the artificial reef program. We've had a significant increase in the number of artificial reef donations over projections. They're running at about 218% of projections, so that's a good thing.
In particular,
you really can't schedule when they're going to decommission one of those offshore rigs, so we just don't know in advance. So you know we make a projection, but we can either run well over or well under.
Okay.
Just because we don't really set the schedule for the deactivation of those offshore rigs. Looking at a summary of our budget adjustments since last January when we last met, we've made an increase in budget of $7.1 million. That's mostly associated with two categories, one being grants, which is a pass-through, mostly Section 6 pass-through grants to local communities for acquisition of endangered species habitat. And the other is in capital construction, and most of this is donation for capital construction of two specific
construction initiatives that we have going on, one being Game Warden Academy and the other one being Kerr Wildlife Management Area. When you look at budget versus expenditure, with 42% of the year elapsed, we have 58% of our budget remaining. If you look at salaries and operating, we're pretty much right on line, 42% of the year remaining, 46% of our salaries remaining, 44% of our operating. Our two principal anomalies are in grants, and this is mostly driven by local park grants. And if you remember, we do our local park grants in our awards at two times during the year, one in January and one in August, so we don't necessarily track with the calendar year there. And in capital, and as we discussed the capital issue earlier in terms of the Rider 30 issue. At this time, I will turn it over to Julie Horsley to kind of give you a update on our current strategic planning initiatives.
For the record, my name is Julie Horsley. I'm the Director of Planning and Analysis and Administrative Resources Division. At the last commission, we reviewed the strategic planning process and highlights of our proposed structure changes. And since that time, there have been a number of new developments we just wanted to provide you an update on today. Regarding our strategic planning and budget structure, we submitted our proposed structure and measure changes to the LBB and the governor's office on April 16th. We also met with both the LBB and the governor's office to discuss our request. At both meetings, there was quite a bit of discussion regarding our proposed consolidation of the inland fisheries management and coastal fisheries management strategies. Unfortunately, neither office seemed very receptive to that proposal. They did, however, seem okay with most of the other changes that we were asking for, which primarily affected performance measures and definitions.
Can I go ahead and interrupt? Did they give you any particular issues on the inland and coastal?
Primarily, it was an issue of reduced transparency. I think the consolidation wouldn't allow them to see expenditures at the lower level of detail between coastal fisheries and inland.
Such as?
Well, you specifically cannot see if dollars are being spent in coastal or inland when they're all rolled into a single strategy.
Yeah, so you have a constituent, may have a constituent issue. How do I tell my inland water constituency, for example, that
right.
X dollars have been spent versus coastal?
Right, because when you're looking at it at that level, at the legislative level, when you look at it from an agency budget level, you can see it, but you cannot see it at a legislative strategy level.
Right. Good thought.
We hope to get final approval of our structure changes over the next couple of weeks so we can incorporate any changes into our final strategic plan document. In addition to negotiating the budget structure and measure changes, we've also been working on developing a draft of the strategic plan. We solicited and compiled input from each division and met with the executive team and division directors to review this input and identify key areas to highlight in the plan. For example, some of the funding needs that are identified for inclusion include funding for staff compensation, information technology needs, capital repair and construction, land acquisition and facility development, maintenance and minor repair, and then finally operational funding sufficient to keep pace with cost increases that have occurred. The needs that are identified as part of that strategic plan will then form the basis for submission of our legislative appropriations request. We hope to have a draft available for circulation internally by the end of May, actually next week. And once the edits resulting from this initial review are incorporated, we'll plan to have a draft copies ready for commission review sometime in mid-June. And the final plan is due to the LBB and the governor's office by July 11th. That concludes my comments.
And based on some of the discussions that we hear here today, I've just got through talking with Julie that we'll probably talk about some public hunting opportunity also.
Yeah.
Well, probably need to be including that. Finally, just to give you an update on the legislative appropriations request, or the LAR, where we are right now. If you remember at the January commission meeting, we talked about the fact that the base of our legislative appropriation request is basically a mean of our total expenditures for FY09 and our budgeted amount for our total expenditure for FY08 and our budgeted amount for FY09. So our base doesn't really get established until we finish our budget preparation process for FY09. We're currently in the budget preparation process right now, and so that's kind of the next step to go through in the process. We received our LAR instructions in early May, and those instructions included a couple of things that were different than what we might have expected. We were kind of expecting to see the base be established as a percentage, say 95% of the prior year base, but it actually was established at 100%. So we're working with 100% LAR submission. With the exception that they asked for us to prepare a supplemental schedule that would identify where we would cut up to 10% of our budget. So
specifically, though.
Specific.
In certain areas, not 10% overall.
It's 10% overall.
Oh,
and we can apply it to whatever areas okay. that we see fit, but we would have to take a 10% cut.
Versus in the past, we've been instructed to just cross the board, wasn't it, 10%?
Well, it was the same way. It's kind of the same way. It's just that this is a supplemental schedule as opposed to actually being the base, which is a good thing. It's a really better way to do it. That 10% cut would represent about $7.5 million annually in GR funds and about $16 million annually in GRD funds. That's dedicated general revenue. That's Fund 9, Fund 64, and a handful of others. So we'll have to be working diligently to identify where we would strategically make those cuts to identify that level of funding in the agency, and that will become part of a supplemental schedule within the LAR.
Just one question. Understanding that our baseline may not exceed the 2008.
Well, your baseline would be established by what you expended in FY08 and what you budgeted in FY09. It would be an average of those two.
Okay.
That becomes your FY10, FY11 base budget.
And what if what if we needed to exceed that by 10%? We have requested.
It becomes an exceptional item.
So then it becomes an exceptional item.
And as Julie indicated, we've identified a number of exceptional items that we would like to explore, such as staff compensation.
Right.
You'll hear some more from Al Bingham about some of the surveys of organizational excellence, the data from that, which indicates that we do have a compensation issue within the agency. Land acquisition funding is another exceptional item, or a 10%, as you said, if we wanted a 10% increase in overall appropriation in a given initiative, that would be considered an exceptional item. We try to limit the number of exceptional items because you're only going to get so much attention on over at the Capitol, and so we try not to add a whole lot. We have three sessions ago we went in with 17 exceptional items, and that was last session we went in with 7 exceptional items. That was getting closer to an optimal number, I believe. So with that, I would take any other questions that you may have.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Committee item number 3 is the internal audit report. This is Carlos Contreras' first report.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Carlos.
Carlos is from El Paso, so he's got a lot of
You have instant credibility.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
might add, we're going to have an internal audit report. The chairman and I discussed it as part of our regular presentation.
Well, good morning, Chairman Holt, Commissioner.
Good morning. Welcome.
Mr. Smith, my name is Carlos Contreras, and I'm the Director of Internal Audit. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to provide an update on the operations of the Office of Internal Audit. I'm joined today by Cindy Hancock and Ed Best. These are the two individuals who manage the auditors that we have out in the field. And given that, our presentation is going to start with an update of the park audits. In round two, the field work was completed in 8 parks. Through the first 2 rounds, we've had 17 parks that we've completed. The round two report is currently in the last stages of review, and we anticipate a release date for that second report being sometime next week. Round three, the field work has been completed in 11 parks. We've got a total of the 28 parks completed here, and approximately 80% of the review process has been completed. In round four, we were able to visit 11 more parks for a total of 39. The actual documentation from the field auditors has been received, and we're initiating the review process on that round. Through 5 rounds, we've completed 51 parks. Of the 95 parks that we identified in the initial risk assessment, this constitutes 53% of the parks. But this also represents approximately 81% of the FY06 state park revenues that we've already taken a look at. In dollar figures, that's $25.5 million of the $31.5 million that we had identified in the risk assessment using FY06 revenue. 44 parks that were identified still remain, and the FY06 revenue is $6 million for those. What we have left on our audit plan. We had planned to do 3 more rounds, one initiating in June, July, and August, the beginning of each of those months. We had originally identified 12 parks that we were going to go visit in the round 6, but we're currently meeting with executive management in order to determine what the biggest bang for our buck is, given that the parks that are remaining have a lot less revenue than the parks in the first few, the first 5 rounds that we did. We're going to get any concerns that management may have, and then we're going to go ahead and plan those, and our start date is still going to be 6-2 of 08 for round 6. Additional work we have going on is a concession audit from Cedar Hill State Park that's in the reporting phase, a concession audit of Eisenhower State Park, which is completing the fieldwork phase and about to enter into the reporting phase. We anticipate both of these reports to be out by the end of the fiscal year of 08. We're initiating an audit of the customer service center here at park headquarters. And that's in the planning phase, but given other competing priorities, we feel that audit may be a carry forward into FY09. Now, as far as the administration of internal audit, I was able to meet with the entire staff on the 14th and the 15th, including all of the field auditors, where we had a really good meeting where we were able to provide them some feedback and give them updated forms and schedules, templates for them to work with. I've revised the audit charter and provided the draft to Mr. Smith and Chairman Holt, and I'm awaiting for their comments or any input they might have, and then we're going to go ahead and seek their approval of that. And I guess based on Chairman Holt's permission, if anybody would like a draft of the audit charter, I can supply that to any of the commission members.
Sure.
Call if we make sure that Chairman Brown gets a copy of that, and I'll do that.
Yes. And finally, internal audit policies and procedures manual and our audit manual are in the process of being reviewed. Thank you. If you can indulge me for just a second, I'd like to recognize the efforts of Cindy and Ed throughout this process.
They put together a really aggressive audit schedule, and they've kept all the field auditors moving along very well. They've put in and continue to put in a lot of long hours in completing this work, so I'd like to thank both of them for their efforts. And that concludes our presentation. If there are any questions, we can answer for you.
I'd like to echo your thanks. Yes. You guys have done a tremendous job in a short period of time. So thank you for your efforts.
Yes, everything from getting the 16 hired to then overseeing, they were all new. And yep. How are they doing? Have they all hung in there?
Yes, they keep coming back.
They keep good. Well, you all have been wonderful giving that direction. And obviously, with college just coming aboard, I assume you're also trying to bring him up to speed. So you've kind of had a double duty. And I agree, absolutely. Y'all have done a tremendous job. So thank you very much. Because, you know, we were just down to visit with Senator Ogden on Monday. I mean, that's the first question. I mean, that's where this lots of questions are going to come once we walk in January of 2009. And that we have to have these done appropriately and be able to present that information to everything from LBB to the individuals that are specifically and directly interested in these audits. So thank you very much. It made a lot of difference. Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Great. Thank you all.
Thank you. Committee item number four is the survey of organizational excellence, and Mr. Al Bingham.
Good morning, Mr. Sherman, commissioners. For the record, my name is Al Bingham. I'm the Human Resources Division Director, and I'm joined by my Deputy Division Director, Jim Lopp, and he's also our resident organizational development expert. And today we're going to present the results of the 2007 Survey of Organizational Excellence. Jim is going to present the meat and potatoes of the survey results and our game plan for moving forward. But I would like to say from the start that from sea level, so to speak, employees generally feel that the agency is moving in a positive direction in most of the areas surveyed, and the timing of the survey results were very appropriate given the entry of Mr. Smith. The survey results came available in early February, and Carter was here in January, so he had some fresh information to work from regarding employees' perception of how the agency is doing. So, Jim?
Thank you. We'll delve into these three specific areas this morning. This is an executive summary, fairly high level for you in respect to your time. We have provided for you the executive summary itself, so you have that available. We're going to spend most of the time on the presentation on the score analysis. That's the interpretation and then the benchmarking within the survey, and then also talk specifically in the game plan section about what specific actions we took the last cycle, that was 2006 cycle, in the game plan that's been approved by Mr. Smith and executive staff for 2008 cycle. These are the basic who, what, when, where, and why questions we thought might be asked. In anticipation of that, we will try to answer those for you. The survey is the only document that is used across the state on a consistent basis to survey employee attitudes. It began in 1979 when then-Governor Clements was talking with the UT School of Social Work and just speculating about what it might be that the average state employee felt about working for the state. It developed from that into a strategic planning document. It is used by us and by all state agencies. It's provided to the governor's office, it's provided to the Legislative Budget Board, to the state auditor's office, and also upon request to the Sunset Review Commission. So it is a strategic document for each and every agency that participates in the process. Secondly, for us, it's an organizational development document. It gives us an opportunity to, on a periodic basis, every other year, assess exactly how our employees feel about working for the agency, what issues and concerns they have, and what recommendations they have. Virtually every state agency participates in the survey. The cost for us with the number of FTEs that we have is less than $10,000. That's about $1.25 per employee. We think that's good value for the money that's out there. And finally, what do we get? We get a comprehensive set of documents, the executive summary that you see before you. We also get a comprehensive data report, so we're able to go in, analyze each question, each one of the constructs, each one of the dimensions that we will talk about in just a minute, and also Excel files so that we can sort those and come up with the reports and analysis in a very structured way so that we can figure out what it is that we have, what it's telling us, and how we can use it. The actual process itself is a classic total quality management continuous process improvement. First thing we do is survey. We did that in the fall of 2007, the early part of December. The assessment phase is where we're at now. Even as we speak, we have a natural leaders focus group going on down in Corpus Christi. The natural leaders program is the agency's leadership development program. We have seven classes that have been through that program. Each year we have about 30 that go through year-long intensive program, leadership training, strategic site visits so that each one of our participants can go cross-divisionally to see what issues and concerns other divisions have so they get a better appreciation for that across the agency. And then finally they have stretch projects out there as well. So that assessment is going on as we speak. And then once we get that information back, then in the latter part of July, July 29th, that project team will bring to Mr. Smith and the executive team a set of recommendations. Some, if not all of those, will be approved, and we will implement those. And then in November, December 2009, we will once again survey and complete that process wheel. The slide looks at participation, and as an agency, we have consistently participated in the survey. We have participated 11 of the 14 cycles. You can see that our participation rate has fairly consistently improved. Anything over 50% is considered to be a pretty good rate. We have stabilized it at that rate. We would like to see that naturally be a little bit higher than what it is. In way of comparison, we are just a little bit worse than comparably sized agencies, that is 1,000 to 10,000. The average there for the last cycle was 60%. Mission category is 64%, and the overall average 66%. By way of explanation or analysis of that, one of the things that characterizes us as an agency is we are a decentralized agency, and we are geographically dispersed across the state. So we think that plays into that, and we try to compensate for that by doing a good job of getting the information out about the survey. So our objective is to try to get closer to that 60-65%. One of the real values of the survey is the opportunity to benchmark us against comparable agencies, and we have that opportunity in two different areas. First of all, with agencies of comparable size, there were 10 other agencies in our size range, 1,000 to 10,000, that took the survey this cycle. Equally importantly, mission category, that is comparable natural resource agencies. There are nine out there. Four others took the survey during this cycle. Importantly for us, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, which is literally a mirror image of our agency, took that survey, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we move through the presentation this morning. Survey response rate on the left-hand side, you can see that 55% that we talked a little bit about. The collection period for the survey, just for your information, was early December to the latter part of December. So we had a 21-day survey period. It was an online administered survey. And on the right-hand side, you can see the location response, and that is essentially the field headquarters split. As an agency, we're 75% of our FTEs in the field, 25% in the headquarters, and within one percentage point, we have that return rate, which we're very pleased to see. We also, just by way of information to you, analyze the return rate by gender, by race, age, and management, non-management, to see if each one of those segments within the organization are responding at about the rate of representation within the department. And this, in fact, was the case, and we were pleased to see that.
Yeah.
Moving forward, the essential organization of the survey is at the very highest level. There are five dimensions, and you can see those arrayed across there. Work group is the perception of individuals within the organization about how they feel about working in that organization. Accommodations would be essentially the organizational culture. How do I feel about working in the organization? Fair pay is a component of that, and that whole benefits package is included in that as well. Organizational features would be the organizational culture. of the organization. And then in the in the information area, very critical for us, that speaks to do we have the communications hardware and software to communicate across our department, both vertically and horizontally? In the personal area, we're looking at the wear and tear in the workplace of the individual, and are our employees able to balance their work life with their personal life? And our findings in that area are pretty positive. The scores that come into play here for the five dimensions are right below that. They're organized into 20 different constructs. The scores for those constructs are determined based upon 86 standard questions which are asked within the survey. 59 of those are immediate workplace questions. That is, as an individual positioned where I am within the agency, within the Human Resources Division, how do I feel about these specific areas? And a little bit higher level, 11 of those, and these are primarily in the strategic area, which would be in the organizational features. That is, as an employee, how do I feel like we're doing across the entire department, again, from my perspective within the organization. And then finally, we have 16 specific compensation and benefit questions, three specifically on fair pay, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we move forward. This is a very active slide. Let me set this up for you, if I can. What we're seeing here is a point-in-time comparison of where the agency was in 1998 compared to where we are in 2008 on each one of those dimensions that I talked about, and they're arrayed on the left-hand side vertically. Then horizontally, right in the middle, we have each one of those 20 constructs that I talked about. The scoring, for your information, each one of those 86 questions, which results in a construct score, is a classic Likert scale, 1 through 5, with 1 being the lower score and 5 being the higher score. Then that 1 to 5 is multiplied by 100 to get the scale that you see. And the scale is 100 to 500. Fortunately, we didn't have any less than 200, so we're displaying 200 through 500. And we will compare on the next chart with mission agencies, and what we will see is that ourselves and comparable mission agencies, the norm for scoring, the range typically is going to be about 250 to 350. So anything that's below 250, and fair pay is below that for us, and anything above 350 is going to be a very high scoring construct, and we have five of those within the department. What you see in the light blue is going to be our 1998 score. In the color-coded bars, that 19 of the 20 are higher than that. What you're seeing, if it's a blue-shaded bar, that's a strength. That is the five highest scoring. In the red-shaded, that's a weakness. Those are the five lowest scoring, and those that are the yellow are intermediate scoring constructs for us. On average, as Al said at the outset, we're doing very well. What we see here is that over that five administration cycle, we have increased in 19 of the 20 constructs, an average of 14%, and five of those 20 we have increased by 20 or more points. Unfortunately, we can see on fair pay that we have regressed there. We have declined by 75 points. And when we looked at that within the survey, the natural leaders team have some people that are really good with Excel spreadsheets, so we asked them to peel that onion and tell us more about that fair pay. And we'll look at that on this mission comparison slide here in just a minute. So we have more information coming for you on that. What we're seeing here is a slide which is set up comparably. This is us versus mission agencies. Those are the agencies that are doing essentially the same thing that we're doing. That's TCEQ, that's Animal Health Control, Railroad Commission primarily, and a couple of others. But those are the major agencies and the ones that were surveyed this time around. What we're seeing here is that compared to those mission agencies, we have a little bit higher score in 16 of those 20 constructs. The ones that we do not are fairness, availability of information down towards the bottom, job satisfaction, and time and stress. On comparable size agencies, we exceed their scores in all 20 of the 20. In the average, this is the average of all 61 agencies that took the survey, our scores are a little bit lower in 19 of the 20. By that I mean marginally smaller, in most instances 3 to 4 to 5 points. So that kind of puts all of these scores and scoring in perspective for you. The other thing that we think is significant about this in looking at comparable mission agencies is that their strengths and weaknesses are virtually the same as what ours are. 9 of the 10 are exactly the same. So that tells us systemically we're wrestling the same issues that they are wrestling. What we're seeing here, we pay a lot of attention to the field versus the headquarters comparison, so you're seeing a little bit of that here. And what strikes us here as being significant are a couple of things. None of these bars are very long on the differences, but we do see a 9-point difference on fair pay. On this slide, we're showing the field as being 3 points higher than what the average 0 point is, or the average score within the agency. On the next slide, we'll see the headquarters being a little bit less than that by about 6 points. So we think that's fairly significant. The second thing down towards the bottom on availability of information, we see 3 points less there. And on the next slide, when we look at the headquarters staff, we're going to see a plus of 8 there. And just by the way, availability of information is when employees feel that they know where to go to get the information that they need to have, whether that's a directory of other employees or whether it's manuals, regulations, processes, either for the entire department or for a specific division, that information is available out there for them. So we feel pretty good about the fact that there are not significant differences there between the headquarters and the field. This is that headquarters snapshot. The fair pay that we talked about, you can see the difference there, and then availability of information. The change orientation there is a little bit problematic for us. What that says is that as an agency, we are leaning forward, we are willing and open and available to make changes when and if they are necessary, that as an agency, we encourage, permit people to benchmark outside the agency, to be members of statewide, region-wide, or national organizations, to work on projects across geographic barriers and at the national level as well, so that when our employees do that, the feeling is that they're more open to new ideas and they see different ways to do business. A lot of that goes on. This tells us that we can probably do a little bit more of that to be even more effective than what we are today. Another component that we have, which is valuable within the overall survey, is the ability to compare where we are with where we have been. So we're able to look back. This specific slide here, we're comparing our 2008 administration to where we were on 2006. We can see that we're better in 17 of the 20. Fairness we're concerned about because fairness is the employee's perception that there's a level playing field, and that whatever actions are taken, whether they're disciplinary actions, promotion actions, any personnel actions that may be taken, that those decisions are made irregardless of race or gender. Diversity is the valuing of the differences within the workplace, that is based upon race or gender, other lifestyle choices that employees may make. So I do not feel that I am advantaged or disadvantaged based upon that perspective. I'd like to conclude with the final two slides here would be the first, the actions that we took in 2006. Rolling out the data pretty aggressively. We did last cycle and we have done already this cycle. Posted the executive summary, this PowerPoint, so it's available to all employees. There also was an article that Mr. Smith wrote in Tracks and Trails, which is the employee newsletter. Also the This Week, which is the weekly release of what's hot or what's new that comes out of Mr. Carter's weekly staff meeting. And also HR, Al and I, or Al, one of the two of us, presented this to most, if not all, of our divisions, so they had that information. Secondly, almost to the day 2 years ago, we made a fairly comparable presentation to the commission. The change team that we're talking about here is key HR division members and also representatives from each one of our divisions, what we call SOE liaisons. We conducted focus groups for every division, and since parks and law enforcement are a little bit larger, we did two focus groups for them. And then based upon that, we prepared division-specific reports that looked at what we call the drivers, that is, what might be causing, what issues, concerns are out there for employees that cause those scores to be as they are in each one of those 20 constructs, and more importantly, what concrete, specific, measurable actions employees recommend that divisions can take to move that dial for us as an agency. And the construct that we use is what should we start doing, stop doing, or continue doing. And we have seen that some of these actions as implemented have moved that bar for us a little bit. We tell our managers that these 20 constructs can be like a management dashboard for you. You can come up and see if you've got a red up there, then you need to pay attention to that. If you've got a blue, honor that, but get even better if you possibly can. And then finally, we have the next slide would be the approved game plan, which is really a three-pronged plan for 2008. The first is we talked about that natural leaders program and also about the focus group that we have out there working on that. We do have 5 focus groups scheduled. We were in Tyler last week on the 15th, 2 in Austin this week, down in Corpus today, and then tomorrow we'll be in Kerrville. Getting a target size of 40, optimum size 50, break down into 3 different focus groups. And the items that we're narrowing in on this cycle, as approved by Mr. Smith and the executive team, are 3 of the 5 lowest scoring constructs that we have: supervisory effectiveness, team effectiveness, and fair pay. Supervisory effectiveness, you may have noted, we moved the bar on that over a 10-year period by 72 points. That's a 21% increase. However, it is still a low-scoring construct for us. We continue to work on that. By the same token, we've done the same thing with team effectiveness. We've done a lot of team effectiveness training. We have a 3-day team leader training. We have intact work group team building that we do, supervisory effectiveness. We have a 4-day successful first-line management training program. It's been in place for 5 years. We've done 17 different sessions on that. Parks has managing park operations out there as well. So there's a lot of management training that's being done. Total compensation is not just the pocketbook items that employees have, but it's also non-monetary recompense as well. Texas Public Employees Association did a survey in the latter part of 2007. Sent it out online to all state employees and asked them to rank order 21 different benefits. Number 1 was 40-hour work week. 2 was paid time off. Number 3 was casual dress. The lowest scoring was compensation. Right above that was non-monetary compensation. That is, employees want to have more of that from their supervisors. Whatever the supervisor or the agency can do to improve their life, that may not be a pocketbook issue. And then right above that was telecommuting. And we were timely on that because we also have a natural leaders focus group on telecommuting. And that group will be reporting back to Mr. Smith and executive staff as well. Corollary to that, Mr. Smith asked Al and I to sit down with each one of the division directors and their senior staff to review their current report and then what corrective actions they implemented coming out of the 2006 report, what changes they have seen, and how they can use the executive summary, the data report, the focus group report that they got, and identify constructs that the divisions can work on for this cycle. And at this point, we've completed 9 of those sessions. We have 2 remaining. And then finally, Al and Gene McCarty have worked out an arrangement with Texas Commission on Environmental Quality that we will set up a peer group review with them Again, they are mirror image of who we are. We have already exchanged reports with them for 2008. They, like the other mission agencies, have exactly the same strengths and weaknesses that we have, so we will sit down side by side to talk with them. What have you tried that's worked? What have we tried that's worked? What do we need to try so that collectively we can raise that bar for all of our state agencies? That concludes our presentation. We'll be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions?
Pretty thorough.
Yes, very good.
Yeah. Am I right that going to the slide, this
get a copy of
the
survey.
The one with the pie chart?
Yes, sir.
Is that, am I reading this right, that only 26% of the headquarters employees responded?
No, sir. What that says is of those people who responded, 26% of those respondents were from the headquarters.
And, Commissioner, that pretty much mirrors how we are, our composition versus headquarters,
yes,
versus field. Yeah. Follow me. So if you have 100%, you know, rate, yeah, a quarter of our staff are located here, and then the balance are out in the field. So that tracks that pretty well.
Yeah, we're 75-25. So just in terms of the people who responded, that's that breakout. And then the response rate was 55%. And as we looked across different levels within the agency, and we also looked across divisions, the response rate in most areas was pretty close to that 55% rate.
Well, but if you've only got 26% of the staff is headquarters, doesn't that skew the results of this? Should there be two surveys, one for field and one for headquarters, to get a more meaningful response?
Well, what happens in the identification, the demographics at the top of the survey, everybody who responds to the report identifies which division they're in. There's basic gender information up there, race information. So what we're looking to see is everybody answers the same questions, but then we look to see what their, if their perspective is different based upon where they're sitting within the department. If they're a field-based or a headquarters-based employee, if they're a manager, non-manager employee, how long they've been with the department, what their gender is, what their race, those kinds of things.
Well, for example, you said fair pay was one of the concerns that was expressed out of the empirical
data. The lowest scoring, yes, sir.
But is that a concern that's equally expressed among the headquarters people as well as field? I mean, can you derive that from this?
Yes, sir. When we look at the headquarters score on fair pay, we see that that is a little bit lower than what we see for the field. So that's one of the advantages, abilities that we have within the survey. So what that tells us is that neither one of those two groups felt significantly different, but that the field staff were 2 points higher than what the headquarters staff were on that. So if we put those two side by side, this is showing us on the field on fair pay that they were a little bit above, and then when we look at the headquarters on fair pay, we can see that they're, 6 points below that. So we do have that ability to come in on each one of those constructs and look to see what that comparison is. And using the data report, we can go into fair pay. There are 3 questions on fair pay. I feel like my pay, I'm adequately paid, fairly paid for the work that I do. I feel like compared to others doing comparable work, I'm fairly paid. And then the 3rd question is my pay paces cost of living. So when we sit down with the divisions, we can come in on fair pay and look divisions by divisions, because on some of the divisions, they're a little bit above or a little bit below, because we do have a law enforcement division, they're on salary schedule C, and we have other divisions who are on salary schedules A and B. So we can come in division by division to look to see where they are on fair pay, and then we can also look at levels within the department to see where they're at on fair pay as well. And we can do that and have done that with all of those constructs, and that's the value of having those Excel spreadsheets out there.
Is it a fair conclusion to say that the employees in the field don't have an issue with don't have as much of an issue with pay as the headquarters group?
That's what we're being told here, but I would caution that a delta of 8 points, two higher in the field and six less in the headquarters, with just an 8-point differential on a 500-point scale is not statistically significant, but it does tell us that there is just a little bit of difference there.
And intuitively, most of the headquarters folks are in high-cost Austin versus the folks in the field are in lower-cost, maybe rural areas out there where the cost is a little bit lower.
What about participation? It troubles me that we only get 55%. You say 65 as a target. What can we do? What do you think can be done to improve the participation? Maybe get a greater percentage of the people?
Yeah, there are several things that we have done, and we have been going back to that just real quickly. We've been as low as 39% on that. Come down, and we can see that we were 2004. At 39%, then we went to 54, 55. The things that we have done is to very aggressively market this, to put out through the Tracks and Trails, which is the employee newsletter. It's actually a payroll stuffer that goes into the pay envelope, and we all pay attention to that. So we put a heads up in there that the survey is coming. Be prepared to complete it. We also put it out through Mr. Smith's weekly staff meetings so that the divisions can then put that down for employees. We also put it out on our website, the intranet, the WildNet. There's a section up there when you first open that up that says what's new out there, and this is one of the things that's done as well. Periodic emails that we send out as a heads up, as a reminder. We work with the UT School of Social Work to draft out a letter which goes out electronically to all employees, which is a heads up that the survey is coming. Out there, so it's a combination of things that we do. We also encourage the divisions to make sure that employees know that they can take, they're encouraged to take the survey on work time. We also make sure that they understand that their reports are anonymous, that information is not shared with anybody. It comes from the UT School of Social Work and goes back to the UT School of Social Work. Kind of put it in context, 55% is considered to be a pretty good return rate. However, the average state agency is a small agency headquartered in Austin with fewer employees than what we have. So we put that out there as benchmarks to say, yes, we would like to be at 60-65, and we are getting a little bit better, and we think we can get to 60-65, and we ask employees, you know, what can we do to get that information out there to make it, to even increase the survey size.
Do other agencies conduct it at the same time that you did in early December?
There are two different cycles. It's every other year. So there were 61 in our cycle, so there would be about 61 in another cycle. We have been in that fall time frame for some time. We're trying to look at across the department. Each one of the divisions have different time frames that might work best for them. So that's a good idea. We can go back and see if there's not a better time frame for us. We try to stay away from spring break and the very ending of school, or right when people are returning to school, the height of hunting or fishing, so that we can try to optimize the number of employees that are returning.
I mean, you're right in the heart of the hunting season and right before the holiday season. Yeah. And have you ever asked people why they don't participate?
Well, we don't know specifically who didn't, but we could go out and ask, is there a better time frame? If you're not participating, what would motivate you to participate? So we could move that time frame either back or forward. That's the agency's choice as to when we would participate in that.
Commissioner, I just want to add to this. There's a lot of process-related things that could happen to probably improve participation, at least marginally. I've asked that question out in the field when I'm doing town hall meetings. ultimately the most important thing we can do to drive increased participation is to act. We've got to demonstrate that we're hearing our colleagues out there, that we're listening, and that we're taking action on all of these things. And I think that ultimately will be the biggest driver for our team wanting to participate in these surveys, knowing that their feedback is heard and it's acted on. And I really feel strongly about that. So if we're able to make demonstrable improvements with respect to our total compensation plan that we're working on throughout the state for all staff, if we're able to make market improvements with enhancing our supervisor effectiveness and we're improving our internal communications, I think we're going to see our participation continue to go up as people feel like they're being heard and it's being acted on.
And at 50%, we're getting statistical relevance, aren't we? I mean, we're getting a 40%.
Yeah, that's definitely statistically significant when we get down to that. And then we drill down on each one of those demographics that we talked about. Just to reinforce real quickly what Mr. Smith said, the five focus groups that we've done so far, the very first focus group, folks would approach me at break and say, Jim, by the way, what did we do about that, you know, in 2006? So the second focus group, we said, this is what we did with that survey result in 2006. So I think that's perhaps the most important thing we can do is not just feed the information back to employees, but tell employees specifically what did we do in those areas. And that's the reason that this year, to improve that, we sat down with the divisions to make sure that the divisions did something with the report that we provided them in 2006 and worked to assist them to identify constructs that they should be working on and ways that they can work. But it really comes down to two things, I think. When I first got here, employees would call and say, Jim, can you assure me that this is confidential? So we ensure the confidentiality is the first thing. And the second thing, like Mr. Smith said, that we're going to do something, that you took your time to complete the survey, we're going to respect that, and we're going to follow through on the recommendations and suggestions that you made. I think those would be two things, and we'll certainly look at the time frame as well.
Thank you. Mr. Park.
Jim, Al, I love these kind of things because it really, you know, this is a novel. This is a novel. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's a novelty. Mm-hmm. It is a novel in the highest sense.
Yes.
Of the literary term.
Mm-hmm.
Because it tells us so much about our folks.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Robert, how can we use this downtown? Because there's a story to be told here downtown. And I don't have the answer for that, but I believe that there is a story to be told downtown. This is a good book on us. This is what our people think about TPWD, and I think it is, I think we should wrap this in some sort of a nice package and hand it out.
This information is provided in the legislative summaries as part of that package that, before the beginning of the session.
Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, a lot of those packages that go down to downtown to those offices, you know, really don't. I think this is something that we need to broadcast.
I think it's Gene
at a timely moment.
I think, as Gene mentioned, again, getting back to the fair pay issue, lease compensation is going to be one of the areas highlighted on our legislative appropriation request, and obviously we'll use this data to support a lot of that rationale.
Now you're getting there. Now you're exposing part of this great novel that we have.
Mr. Parker, I think that's an excellent observation. I think the other thing that I would say about that is that we work very closely with the UT School of Social Work. We're part of a 4 or 5 agency work group that's assisting them to take a fresh look at that. What happens with these results is that they're made available to the legislature, prior to every legislative session, every agency has a snapshot which is done, and there are profiles that come in out of this. The other thing is that each one of these agency reports are rolled up into a state report that goes forward. That's why we mentioned that we have the same strengths and the same weaknesses. And the discussion that we've had with the UT School of Social Work is that in organizational development work, if you see a lot of agencies that have fair pay, in fact, every one of them has fair pay as dead last, that's a systemic issue that needs to be addressed. So that comes from the agency up through and across over to the governor's office, legislative budget board. So that's why I say it is a strategic document. And that's just one example, but Alan's right, that's probably the best example. That is the live issue which comes out of this survey for us as an agency.
Hey, Commissioner, we have done a lot of work in that regard in talking with our partners and constituent groups and legislators about fair pay issue. And just to sort of augment that with a little bit of additional information, I mean, consider the fact that 100% of our administrative staff are paid at the lowest quartile. We have a turnover rate with our fish and wildlife technicians of about 40% every 2 years. And our professional staff, meaning our scientists, are paid somewhere between 10 and 15% below our benchmark state agencies. And that's not looking at that in comparison to the private sector. So we're having real recruitment and retention issues that are very demonstrable, that are affecting our hiring and our retention of very key, high-performing personnel. And so please know that it is the highest issue on our management team's radar screen, and we're talking about that with all of the constituents and stakeholders and helping to advocate for funding opportunities to help rectify that. So,
all right, carrying the message.
Very good. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, guys.
Mini item number five is facility use fees at Perry Haynes Ranch, and Mr. Ernie Gamage is going to make a presentation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, for the record, my name is Ernie Gamage. I'm the Urban Outdoor Programs Branch Chief housed in the Communications Division. I'm happy to be here with you this morning. I'm here to present specifically response to public comment to amendments that were published in the Texas Register in April regarding fee structure for Perry Haynes Ranch. To refresh your memory, Perry Haynes Ranch is a 4,500-acre ranch in Bell County that abuts to Fort Hood. We lease it from the Texas Youth Commission. And the will that ended up bringing this ultimately to us stated that it should be used for the children of Texas. The ranch itself is divided into two parcels. On the eastern side is the equestrian center, has about 45 miles of trails, horse pens. There's a clubhouse there. It's really a beautiful facility and much used by our equestrian friends. The western parcel, which we call the Hilltop Complex, provides facilities, lodging, meals, and activity opportunities. And among these opportunities include sporting clays, fishing, kayaking, archery, overnight camping, equestrian trail rides and camping there, ropes course, and various day uses of the ranch, including hiking and fishing and so forth. The current fee structure, which was put together shortly after about $2 million worth of facilities were put on the ranch, does not include all facilities and activity uses. These fees were originally promulgated in February of 2004, nor does it recoup the majority of our operational expenses to the department for the ranch. The proposed fees speak to several of these things, and here's what they do. First of all, they provide a base fee for all ranch users for overnight lodging, meals, and the various activity opportunities. Provide a discount of 40% for youth groups who may choose to use the ranch, and provide for all activities and facilities and uses a fee range at the low end, which will be the current fee charged, up to a higher range that could ultimately be imposed for these fees as time passes. For example, in the facility side, the Hilltop Complex, the current fees put together in 2004 were for 1,000
to $5,000. And over time and use, it's obvious that that is a little broad, and we have changed that proposed range from $2,250 to $3,500 based on use and also our work talking to other similar facilities. In the current facility fee schedule, there is no fee for renting a cabin, and that is how we are choosing to rent cabins in the future rather than by the bunk, which has been problematic for us for a number of reasons. The proposed fee sets at cabin rental, which houses 18, I believe, individuals, from $400 to $600 is the range. And finally, meals, which were originally set in a range of $21 to $48 per day, we realized not everybody may choose to have all three meals, and so we've broken that out from $5 to $25 per person, depending on meal choice per day. Public comment, we have received six public comments, two opposed, and the number for support is incorrect there. That should be four, so it's two opposed and four for. The comments opposing the fee changes, one said that it was too high already, and the other one said that $40 was too much for the cowboy cabin, which is in the equestrian area. That $40 is at the highest end of that range. The actual fee that is charged right now and will be charged in the future is $20. That is a very, very rustic cabin. I would point out to you that since these fees were published, we realized that we wanted to make a recommendation to them regarding sporting clays. In the published fees, the range was $20 to $40 per person per day. We'd like to lower that to make it yet more affordable, especially for youth groups, to $10 per day, which we would set that fee at. So the fee proposed would be $10 to $40. And we request that this item be placed on tomorrow's agenda for public comment and action. And I'll be happy to entertain any questions.
Any questions?
What do you get for the $10?
For sporting clays,
you
get an opportunity to shoot. We have five stand out there, and you must provide the birds and ammunition, but you get to come out. We'll be having for example, a sporting clays fundraiser by the Friends Group that will be out there later on this year.
If you,
go ahead.
If you're using part of the facility and you've taken maybe 18, 20 people for one of the cabins, do you pay an extra entrance fee too?
No, Perry Haynes Ranch is not like a state park. It is not, we don't have a kiosk at the gate where you pay to come in. It is by booking only, and that's one of the things that makes it unique. Nobody just wanders in up there. We have no walk-on traffic. So you would make a reservation specific to your needs, and then we would help accommodate you when you got there.
What's our current utilization?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember, Commissioner, the actual day use, but it's pretty darn incredible. We have a staff of three up there right now to manage the ranch, and they are booked up solid. During the summer, for 2.5 months, the C5 Leadership Foundation actually has a camp that has previously been called Camp Coca-Cola. And so we have no use of the western side of the facility. There continues to be an equestrian riding on the eastern side.
Any other questions? No further questions or discussion. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment.
Yeah. Thank you, Arnie.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this committee has...
Great. Thank you. We will move on to the Conservation Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Due to the hour and the fact that we have several items to discuss in executive session, I will... stray from the agenda and go ahead and announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act and seeking legal advice from the General Counsel under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act, and deliberations of a prospective gift or donation under Section 551.073 of the Open Meetings Act. Thank you.
So what is that?
Stand adjourned.
We're going up.